morning, and thank you for attending the Lasard Sands Outdoor Heritage Council meeting. The first item on the agenda is to approve the agenda.
I'll move approval, Mr. Chairman.
Member Tilly moves approval of the agenda. Discussion on the motion or the agenda? Member Hartwell.
So I see on the agenda we have a presentation by the lobbyist for the ATV Association. I don't think it's fair to have a lobbyist make a presentation without some opposing view in terms of the effects of ATVs, specifically some research organization presenting at the same time. So I'd like to make a motion to amend the approval to put off the presentation until we get a balanced presentation.
Well, we have both the association and the DNR, and I think as you and I discussed, the Department of Natural Resources is the responsible government unit for ATV regulations, and so I think that we do have a review organization on hand to also give their opinion and information.
But they're required to enforce the laws. I'm suggesting we find a research organization that has researched and can present the research on the effects to wildlife, which I'm not sure the DNR is here today to do.
Well, I think the DNR understands the effects on habitat and wildlife. Member Blackburn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, the whole issue with ATVs has come up, you know, numerous times, and I believe that Mr. Bowen came to a previous meeting and talked about this and asked for additional time on our agenda. He was going to be on last time, and he was bumped. I mean, I don't think this is a surprise, and I certainly think that we need to learn more about it, and I see no issue with learning more about it from Mr. Bowen this time, and if we have additional questions or want to seek the advice or input that Councilmember Hartwell discusses, we can do that today. But I think this has been something that has been intentionally put on the agenda, and I would just soon go forward.
Thank you. Other discussion with regard to the motion or the agenda?
Was there a motion?
There was a motion.
Yes, motion by Member Tilly to approve the agenda.
Oh,
and I made a motion to amend the agenda, motion.
Well, I would just comment, agree with Member Blackburn. This is not a court hearing or whatever, and I'm interested in what he has to say. It doesn't mean anybody here has to agree with any of it. And in addition, in item 11, opportunity for the public to address the council, he could go there at his pleasure. So let's hear what he has to say. I got no issue.
Member Tilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I sort of in the same place. I would like to hear what we have here because there's no agenda item that we're voting on as a result of this presentation. I, too, would like to hear from the other side. I think that makes a great deal of sense. Doesn't necessarily have to happen at the same day. The other presenters can surely look at our video or our listen to the audio of Mr. Bowen's presentation, and so that we aren't missing out on anything. I would just soon go ahead today.
Member Olson?
I actually agree with David. It's one thing to say that the DNR is here and can talk about it, and something else to have them actually have prepared remarks and the research in hand. If we're going to let this go ahead, then I think we need to schedule an equal amount of time for them to have a prepared discussion on the research behind it, not just, oh, what do you think? We just asked you today.
Member Blackburn?
On the agenda, it has two presenters, doesn't it?
Correct. I don't
the
know.
DNR that. And Mr. Bone?
Correct. So we have the amendment to not have the presentation.
I am willing to withdraw my amendment on the condition that we get some researcher in here who studied the effects outside of the DNR. I'm happy to hear from the DNR, but I'd like independent research on the studies of the effects of ATVs on wildlife habitat. If we can schedule that in December, I'm happy to go forward with the agenda today.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just think that we should be careful that we stick to what we're here for. This is a group of citizens and legislators to advise the legislature on developing how to spend the 1/8 of 3/8 sales tax for habitat. And I think we're beginning to act like legislators, and I think we should stick to what we're supposed to be doing. I think it would be beneficial to hear the ATV issue has been one that's been brought to the forefront, and it affects our recommendations. I think we should look at it from that way and not from the direction that we should be developing policy. I think we're outside our responsibilities and what we were sent here to do.
Thank you. Are you withdrawing your...
If I can get a commitment that we will add a research component at the December meeting to talk about the effects of ATVs on wildlife habitat, which is our concern.
Okay. Certainly the agenda is open on for December presentation.
So you'll commit to allowing...
Absolutely.
Great, then I withdraw my motion.
Thank you. And we have the motion on the approval of the agenda as presented. And I don't believe, Member Wilkins is not on, so I think we can just take a voice vote. We don't have to have a roll call vote. Member Wilkins, are you on? We haven't heard from Betty yet. So we'll just have a voice vote on the agenda. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, same sign. Motion is carried. Agenda is approved. Thank you. Go to the approval of the minutes of the September 29 meeting.
Motion to approve.
Motion by Member Blackburn to approve the minutes of September 29. Discussion on the motion or the minutes? Hearing no discussion, Chair would place the question. All those in favor of the motion to approve the minutes of September 29 signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, same sign. Motion is carried. Minutes are approved. Thank you. Any members have a conflict of interest on any item on today's agenda? Hearing none, we'll move to the Executive Director's Report. Mark?
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Short report for you today, a couple things very quickly. First of all, with regards to past action in your packets, good morning, Elizabeth.
Here, good morning.
Good morning, welcome.
All right, for everybody's information, Elizabeth, too, we're trying out a new phone system to try to get some of the glitches out. LCC purchased a new phone system. They'd had some of those glitch problems before that Sue encountered last time for sure. Mm-hmm. So hopefully this is a trial run, but hopefully it will do well. And just so everybody else knows, Elizabeth did mention she may have to, she's not sure, but she may have to be clicking out and in once in a while during the meeting. So Elizabeth, we'll just be patient, and anything you have to do there, you feel free.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right. Members, in your packets, there is a letter with regards to past action. There's a letter from the chair to Commissioner Tom Landwehr with regards to Mississippi River Northwoods. And attached to it, as was attached to the DNR letter, is their accomplishment plan and their final report. So that letter went out on November 1st. Also, just some other information for you. Staff has been at a couple of things here. Back on the 29th, actually, I had the pleasure of going with Member Tilly down to a legislative public forum that was hosted by the Nicollet Sportsman Club and MOHA down at Nicollet. It was quite well attended. There was one legislator there, and there were some DNR people there and a bunch of locals, so it was a really interesting broad spectrum of constituents and people very interested in legislative process. And we had a number of questions directed about OHF and about the council, and so it was, I think, a very good good thing to be at. Also, on October 5th and 6th, Joe and I went on the 5th and he went on the 6th, one day each, to the AIS Summit 2, which Mr. Hickman will be giving an update on the AIS project later, and I believe he'll give some more information on that. But a really well-attended, very well-orchestrated event. It's too bad none of you were able to make it, but it was definitely worth the attendance. Also, another thing to let you know of, we've been working on the bill language draft. That is in hand, but of course, we have some agenda items today that could affect that, and then mainly with the forwarding the accomplishment plans, which we'll have later in the agenda. So once that's all done and today's results are taken into consideration, the bill will go into the next stage of draft and then on to House and Senate research and for their input, and then on the revisor, before the revisor, it'll come back to this body for the December meeting for approval and then on to the revisor. One more thing that I had, I think, is it's small, but in your packet also, again, is a draft 2016 on one side, but also on the other, 2017 calendar for the council. It's in your packets, and it'll come up again. It'll be on the agenda at the December 14th meeting. It is basically a placeholder, so you can look at your calendars looking forward. My recommendation in December is going to be that the council tentatively adopt a 2017 calendar and that would be a precursor to the next council in March, prospectively in March, adopting a final calendar at that point. But at least it gives some placeholders so people have an idea where their calendars are, and that seems to be where the calendars will have to be looking, and that seems to be a request we've had all along. And that is all I have on my report, Mr. Chair, unless there are questions from anybody.
Questions for the Executive Director? Thank you, Mark, and thank you to Member Tilly and to Joe for attending those meetings and events. Move to the agenda item, the Treasurer's Report. Member Blackburn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So from our last meeting where we had the preliminary development of the administrative budget, we postponed approving that in order to just ask a few more questions and try to figure out the details that are in the administrative budget as far as particularly some of the priorities that the Outdoor Heritage Council has had on developing and reporting on outcomes in order to have transparency and accountability on the funds. And so I met with staff numerous times, and we did a lot of brainstorming and thinking through what's the best way for us to account for that as a budget item and make sure that instead of it just being an intention, it's actually something that is worked on and done. So when we reviewed the budget and came up with kind of our plan, we actually think that the budget that was put forward works just fine, and I don't see any need for any changes on that. But what we did develop is this second piece of information that everybody should have that has it's from the Environmental Initiative, and it's Minnesota's Outdoor Heritage Fund, a process to define outcomes and impacts. In our meetings and talking about how do we do this reporting on the outcomes, this is the only fund that actually doesn't have any kind of a coordinated reporting on the accomplishments, you know, that are consolidated. I mean, we have accomplishments reports from each project when they're done, but there's really no kind of overall overall work or document that people can look at that says, okay, this is what all of these funds have done. So we started working, and I know the council staff has done a lot of work thinking through what are various, you know, models or ways that we could consolidate all this information and report and have that accountability. And as we started talking about it, it became a little bit more broad, and we thought that maybe the things that we were thinking about should be opened up to what other people might think we should be reporting about and having accountability and transparency on. And so we called in the Environmental Initiative. The Environmental Initiative has a great reputation for convening groups of diverse groups to discuss and come up with kind of pathways forward for lots of different, even highly controversial projects and topics. And so we thought maybe what we're looking for is kind of a third party to help us think about not just maybe what's in our minds right now about what we should be reporting, but what other folks, you know, what do citizens and public want to hear? So we brought in the Environmental Initiative, and we had a couple meetings and discussed an idea of convening a group in order to develop a plan for what are we going to report on. Is it just miles and acres? Is it, is it birds? Is it economic? Is it, you know, the amount of forestry that's been, preserved? That kind of thing. So what we have in front of you is kind of an initial concept and a design of the process. And with that, I'd like to bring up the folks from Environmental Initiative to discuss this document and plan that they have brought forward. So, Mr. Harley? Where's Mr. Harley? Oh, over there.
Good morning. If you would introduce yourself for the record, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Mike Harley. I'm Executive Director of Environmental Initiative.
I'm Malia Hausnecht, Environmental Policy Director for Environmental Initiative.
Thank you.
I think we'll just say a few quick words about what we're suggesting, and then we can take any questions, if that makes sense. So the process that we've suggested here, I think, recognizes that there's a significant technical component to this conversation, and we want to make sure that we build opportunities for that technical conversation to play out. But we also recognize that there are some other important inputs into this process, and so we've proposed some regional meetings around the state so that we can make sure that we're hearing from across the state's landscape about what is that it is that is important for us to be reporting and aiming for as we make these investments. And then also, ultimately, empowering a group of stakeholders, both fund recipients, other key stakeholders, to sit together and to reach consensus around a set of recommendations that they would then report to this, they would recommend to this council. And so that's ultimately the path that we would see, those inputs flowing in from both those technical subgroups and also from the regional meetings going to that group, that working group, that would then bring recommendations back to this council for your consideration. And it's a fairly straightforward process that reflects work we've done with the Clean Water Fund and with the Parks and Trails Fund as well. So this is a dynamic that we've used in the past and have had some success with. For those of you who may not be familiar with Environmental Initiative, we're a 24-year-old environmental nonprofit. We're based in Minneapolis. We are statewide. And our work is consistently around engagement of citizens, engagement of stakeholders around environmental policy and sustainability. So this is right up our alley. Mm-hmm. I don't know if, Malia, you want to add anything else?
Sure. Happy to answer any questions.
Questions for representatives from the Environmental Initiative?
So,
Member Hartwell?
I just have a generic question, which is I see what you're proposing putting together groups to measure ecological, social, and economic impacts. I'm wondering how we square that with our charge, which is to the funds may only be spent to restore, protect, and enhance wetlands, prairies, forests, and habitat for fish, game, and wildlife. That's our charge by Constitution. So why are we measuring social impacts and economic impacts when our charge is to specifically do work for wildlife habitat? And I'm not saying it isn't, there aren't impacts beyond wildlife habitat, but it seems to me that it's the wildlife habitat that's our complete, should be our complete and total focus by constitutional mandate.
May I take that? Please, member, executive director.
Yeah, if I can take a stab at that, that's a very good question, and it's one I think that more people will wrestle with. From a standpoint of the constitutionality of using funds for it, there is up to 1% of the funds can be used for administrative purposes. We are also, the council is also mandated to report on outcomes and outputs. And I consider that, at least in my mind, that's an administrative function. So I think constitutionally that would fit within that category. We've talked a lot about, since I've been here, we've talked a lot about outcomes, and I know you spoke a lot about it before, too. In fact, as I understand, there was, back before I came into this position, there was quite a bit of input from the legislature, and especially certain legislative members, making sure that outcomes were a very important function that would be reported upon, and that's some of the mandate, I think, that came forward. So. I hope that helps.
Mr. Chair, if I could just respond as well.
Please.
Mr. Chair and Member Hartwell, I think that focus on that set of outcomes came out of our initial discussions with Member Blackburn, with Executive Director Johnson, and I think we're here today in part to take your feedback and your direction about where it is you'd like to see this conversation focus. So I think that's really a question for the council.
Member Blackburn and then Member Kingston.
And additionally, you know, one of the things that we wanted to do is leave this idea of what are our outcomes that we need to report on open for this process. We actually didn't want to restrict it for this process so that when we bring in the technical experts, the public, I mean, there's many of our projects that involve, you know, things like working lands. How do we evaluate those things? Working lands mean people there's an economic impact. It's a forestry impact. It's a grazing impact. And so I think at this point what we're hoping is to not restrict those things that people might want to learn about from the outcomes of the Outdoor Heritage Fund. So I'd like to, and I would definitely advocate for leaving this process at this point as open as possible, and let's convene those groups and say, what is it we actually want to hear about? I'd like to not restrict it at this point. Because it may be important. It doesn't mean that it should be the most important thing, because I absolutely believe that there's a defined purpose here. But we do talk about multiple benefits, and we talk about what these funds mean to that heritage of the state. And I think that's across a wide diversity of measures. So I'd like to not restrict it here and see what folks say, see what the technical experts say, see what citizens say. And what they think they want to hear for the outcome of their taxpayer dollars.
Thank you. Member Kingston and Member Hartwell.
And I think those, thank you. I think those concerns are relevant secondarily, but what I want to stress, and I have before and today and going forward, is what these funds are for, what they're mandated for, and that these other benefits that trickle down from it or ripple out from it are held in that regard. It has to be made very clear, mm-hmm. because the waters are getting muddier and muddier as we go as to what the purpose of this fund is. There's all kinds of necessary work. There's all kinds of really important work that have social and wildlife and political and mm-hmm. Financial outcomes that are beneficial to the state. But this fund is so pure and so limited that I think any step that we take that digresses from the purpose is that of a confusing direction. So if these are included as down the list and, oh, by the way, there are these things that come along with it, on the slipstream, that's fine, but we've got to be crystal clear what it is that this fund and this council is working on.
Agreed.
So I'd have to be couched in those terms. So I agree that I don't even know that they should be on the same list at all. They should be as an adjunct and as a carry forward, you know, because of the power of what this money is destined for. And everybody in this room and in the state has to be very, very clear and reminded all the time as to what this is for. Mm-hmm. Not recreation, not beautification, not urban improvement. Mm-hmm. It's for critters and for habitat, and that's it. Mm-hmm. So we have to stress that point. I think every chance we get, and the need gets greater every year that we go and every round of funding that we have. So as long as it's couched in those terms, there might be lots of other things that could, you know, come with it. Air quality, you know, but let's not go there. Okay. Not now, anyway.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Member Hartwell, then Representative McNamara.
Yeah, I just, you know, I wasn't questioning, Mark, whether or not we can use the administrative budget to do this kind of work at all. My concern is that we try to, or we unwittingly set up a system where we're trying to create incentives for future actions that have nothing to do with the purpose for which this fund is dictated. And I think, you know, to even set up a working group to look at social impacts is sending a message that we're going to judge future requests based on social impacts. We should be judging the work on wildlife habitat impacts, and if there are additional benefits, that's great. And we all know there are, but it ought to be a footnote. It shouldn't be front and center. Mm-hmm. And that's my only concern. I think it's great to, you know, figure out how effective we're doing in terms of wildlife habitat, and then listing other benefits is fine. So I would ask that this proposal, assuming we go forward with it, is modified to reflect that.
Thank you. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess what I would say, and to Member Blackburn, I think this is a great idea. I just think it would be inappropriate to be funded from here. I guess what I would do to the initiative fund is recommend you prepare an LCCMR proposal and widen your scope to maybe all the funds that are involved in the sales tax amendment, parks and trails, clean water, maybe even the arts part too, to look at some of that. It clearly would qualify as an LCCMR proposal and would probably be something good to be done. I guess I would start there before we dive in. I think the legislature is going to have a challenge accepting this and looking at it as part of the administration. It's, I think, not part of the administration. This is above and beyond. You're not being looked at to be administrators. You're doing a new function that may be an important one and I think would be a very valuable LCCMR proposal. And LCCMR is up, is going to be close to $60 million this year and over 50 next year, depending on what happens with that leftover money. So I would hope that maybe that's a thought.
No.
Member Blackburn, I think you'll have a hard time. And the funding here, I think we'd be going above and beyond what we're thinking of if we start funding something like this.
Thank you, Representative McNamara. Member Shara, then Member Blackburn, and then Member Tilley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As an old newsman, I certainly encourage reaching out to the public, and I understand a concern over the ecological, social, and economic impact deal, but I think there's more value in the public understanding what we're doing, and I don't fear having us change our way of operating because we are governed by the Constitution. I'm more interested in hearing what people say about what we're doing and what they think about what we're doing and getting that feedback. And in addition, I'm, as an old newsman, I'm totally amazed that we sat here a month or so ago and handed out $115 million and based on what I can read in the major newspapers, there was no coverage of it. I go, really? I don't understand that. And I blame them, not us. But I also remember quite a few years ago, the legislature, or we were told they would get in a knot if we started publicizing ourselves, promoting what we did. I don't quite understand that because a lot of other state agencies do that. But if that's not a point anymore, I would say at some point we should maybe just invite the major media here when we have a meeting. Maybe they don't know about it.
Thank you. Member Blackburn, then Member Tilley.
Well, last year, this council and the staff was mandated through legislative action to do a PILT assessment, which is a tax issue, and certainly not within the purview of this council. You know, I think the whole idea, as far as the social and economic impact, to say that there isn't an impact is, you know, would be crazy. To say that we should go into it at this kind of a level of discussion is certainly, I get that. I mean, I completely get that. And we don't ever really want to put out that image that it's not about habitat, which it certainly is. But I think people might be interested in what those secondary impacts are. And so I'm totally flexible on that. But I think it's astounding that this council and its membership doesn't believe it's important to consolidate the results of these funds and communicate it in a way that's transparent and accountable to the taxpayers of the state. And I don't think that's beyond our control. I don't think that's outside our purview. I think it is 100% what we should be doing. And every other fund is doing that. And I don't know what it means for us, you know, if it's another 10 years down the road to look back and say, oh, geez, well, I think we did some stuff. But I don't know what it was or what the impact is. We've been talking about this since this was created. And it's time to get to work and do it. It shouldn't be an intention. We should have a way that we can tell people what's happening with this fund. And it is an administrative function. Every single group that manages a fund that ends up doing something, every grant manager, everybody's got to report on outcomes, but we don't? No. That's our responsibility. 100%.
Thank you. Member Tilley, then Member Kingston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I'm sort of agreeing with a lot of people in this room. I agree with Member Hartwell about I don't think our obligation here is to measure social and economic outcomes. I think our constitutional obligation is to measure the outcomes as it relates to habitat. I agree with Representative McNamara that I think it's good politics, and which means good for our political future, to measure some of the social and economic outcomes. But I like his approach of seeking another avenue to measure that and combining all of the aspects of the legacy amendment, not just ours. And I do think we have an obligation to measure the outcomes and report them. So I kind of like the bifurcated approach that we stick to our constitutional duty on this and to participate in a broader measure of outcomes of all the constitutional amendments and similar to the path that Representative McNamara has recommended. Thank you.
Thank you, Member Tilley. Member Kingston.
I'm kind of with you, Barry. I think that measuring outcomes is incumbent upon us, and we are now. I mean, we're looking at acres, easement, acquired, fee acquired, all the work that's being done as far as restoration and enhancement. And I want to point out the differences, you know, when we're a work group that serves the legislature, and when the legislature tells us to do something like a PILT study, obviously that's what we're going to do. I just don't want to overstep what it is we're supposed to do, and I want to add on to what it is that we are doing now, in what way we want to measure that, I think this group can certainly address. And we've talked about that a lot as in terms of not just acres and dollars, but, you know, what kind of impact it is on populations, for instance. But what is the cost estimate of this, by the way?
Well, Can I address that?
Please.
Mr. Chair.
Member Blackman.
So, you know, we wanted to make sure that we brought this forward first and developed what it is. And if I understand what you're saying about kind of bifurcating, so that those other kinds of impacts aren't part of this, but that we are really narrow in just addressing the constitutionality, you know, aspects of it. I totally understand that. So I think we'd probably have to go forward. I mean, we're in the past, and speaking with staff, in the past, the efforts that have been about developing the 25-year plan framework, as well as really developing the first kind of materials about this, there was one of those was didn't involve a lot of travel or out-state meetings. That was about 85. The one that was larger that involved more meetings out state and gathering citizen input, I think was closer to 150. So depending on really the scope of what we decide to do as far as topics, as far as developing kind of that the process and where it's going to take place, I would say those are kind of really the bookends. But I certainly would be, you know, willing to adjust, and this is what we bring it forward for, right? I obviously, you know, my passion is that I think we need to report on what we're doing. I mean, that shouldn't, in my mind, be much of a question at this point. That we're so far behind is more of a question, and that we would delay it longer is curious. So I think, you know, if we adjust this based on the feedback of the council, make sure that we are addressing it the right way, but you know, to move forward. So in that range, and why we wouldn't have to make any adjustments to the administrative budget is actually because of the carry forward that we have in the administrative budget.
So Julie, are you saying that this 85 to 150K would be included in the 571K?
In the carry forward funds, yes.
571 plus whatever was carry forward? Do we carry forward whatever isn't spent year by year by year? That's not building up every year.
Executive Director?
So what's the total in there now?
These are actually administrative budgets. We have,
right.
from last year, we have about $126,000 that was carried forward. And that was as of last year's budget. There's a previous carry forward balance too, but for this biennium so far already, it's $126,000.
I guess I'm asking, what is the total?
Total for carry forward?
Last year you said 126 carry forward plus what we're budgeting this year?
Total in our carry forward is around $700,000 right now.
Well, that's great. But I think that it is our job to help set those budgets and put some parameters on it. And I wouldn't authorize anything more than 85 until we have a greater definition as to what that consists of. I'd like to see what that really consists of. And I don't want to micromanage every little thing, but I think it is our job to look at budgets and what we're making expenditures on, and making sure that they're appropriate to what our function is.
Mr. Chair, if I could just clarify that for a minute. So this would be something that would go out for an RFP.
Okay.
Because it meets the threshold that it would need to be done. And so, you know, that's going to come back. That's going to be developed. It's not, even though an environmental initiative helped us really figure out and kind of pull our ideas together about these things, it's beyond where we're at this process right now to talk about the specifics of the funds.
Thank you. Executive Director Johnson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, just a little bit more extra information for background for you. In this process of sitting down with EI, it was interesting to me to find out that they had actually worked with Clean Water Fund in the same process, basically. They also worked with Parks and Trails in the same process. So there have been other processes by other legacy groups or legacy funds that have gone forward that we would not be trying to replicate through this. Basically, pardon? Yeah, we could do that. but it would, in fact, what we'd be trying to do definitely is work with those parties to bring in those, as you mentioned very adequately, Member Kingston, as secondaries, because mm-hmm. We know that forestry work creates clean water. That's not the primary focus of it from a habitat standpoint, but it's a secondary, and we would definitely make sure that that's framed in that manner.
Okay, Member Hartwell.
So I have to admit I am a little surprised that we've got $700,000 carryover in our administrative budget. Why do we even have a budget in this year's allocation for administrative costs when we could just do nothing and have enough money to carry ourselves and have additional funds? It's not like we're never going to get more administrative money and we need to squirrel it away.
I'd rather spend it on habitat.
Would you like me to take that, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please, Executive Director.
Yes, actually, and that was the carry forward was, as I understand, was established through council. I wouldn't say negotiations, but a conference with council members, if not the council itself, with Mr. Becker. And the reason for the carry forward originally was for several reasons. One was, what if the bill didn't pass? How do you have the administrative dollars or budget to actually allow the staff to do its work if necessary? Another thing is that if you don't, if there were legal suits, how would those legal suits be paid for? Would they come out of the administrative budget? If so, would they come out of special appropriation from the legislature, and et cetera? And another is looking long range, which I don't think this full answer has been fully, question has been fully answered, but it was looking at long range. What about in the final years of the sunset years of the Outdoor Heritage Fund? If it's not renewed and we don't have a bill for all the money is appropriated and gone out, how do you pay for those final 5 or 6 years of, at least it would be 5 or 6, of some type of staff residual to do the final accomplishments with the plans, to pull in the final figures and make sure the money's spent properly at the end and everything's closed out? And if it isn't an Outdoor Heritage staff, I won't be here then, believe me. In another 2034, I hope to be retired. if it isn't an Outdoor Heritage staff, it will be some successor of the staff. And would the money come out of the general appropriation from the legislature, or should it come out of this fund? I think those were all questions that were in the building of the carry forward originally.
And so I guess just a question, Member Blackburn. So in the RFP process, the determination will be made as to a third-party group that would conduct such a
correct
review?
Yes.
And report?
Yes, that's correct, Mr. Chair. And we can move forward based on the impact, you know, the feedback that we've gotten from you guys about really the scope. That was what we really need to figure out, was that scope, get that feedback, and go forward. Again, this has been an intention and discussed since day one. And we continue to talk about it. Well, we need to report on outcomes. And so we're just trying to figure out, what does that mean? And it's so obscure right now. What does that mean? And so how do we kind of consolidate, you know, particular metrics and report on that on a regular basis, not just once? I think the idea of reporting on those secondary benefits of all of these funds is a kind of a fascinating idea. I hadn't thought about it that way. And I think that would be a really important work, but I definitely can concur with this just being really narrowly defined for the purposes of this fund. So I think I would like to see if we could go forward based on the input that we've gotten, revise this and go forward with the RFP process. And then, you know, it sounds like you guys might have some interest in reviewing the responses to that when they come back. Before moving forward, and I don't know what your desire is as far as level of involvement, approval, review at that point.
Representative or Member Sheriff, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, we all love this. I kind of like the idea that the council stay, that we go out and hear some of this, maybe have our meetings moving around the state. And when you're looking for outcomes and impact, I think it would be somewhat foolish of us to go tell the folks in Worthington what we've done down there. I think the folks in Worthington will tell us what we've done. Mm-hmm. And I think the folks out in western Minnesota will tell us what our money has done for waterfowl in various places that we've had impact there. So I don't think the impact is a mystery in this state at all. It's just that we're probably not hearing it here in our isolated St. Paul environment. I hear it out there, but so there is impact, and I'm conflicted about going to Madison, Minnesota, and telling the people how many pheasants I produce for them. They know more than we do. So I guess I would just conclude by saying the impact is not a mystery out there. Yes, we could have more publicity about it, more knowledge about it, because I also hear people saying, what are you doing with my tax money? But I also think maybe we should move around the state with our meetings, and that would be an eye-opener for us as well as them.
Mr. Chair.
Member Blackburn.
I agree. But I also want to make sure it's clear that we aren't doing this to tell people what's been done. We have to report on the things that they already probably know, but in a way that actually has some metrics besides saying we did good things. And additionally, the science is changing. And we in this last round, we challenged applicants to define outcomes, and there was some pushback on that about. So how do we measure how many, ducks, et cetera, based on habitat models? And so it's a little bit more than just saying, we've done good things here and we've stored some wetlands here, but what does it mean for that kind of the long game? And we've talked, when I was meeting with the staff, various models that you could take all of these reports of outcomes that come in, what was actually accomplished, and try to define it in a way that is much more kind of contextual that people can relate to and consolidate all of that information in some metrics. And one of the things that's been done, for instance, like with the Clean Water Fund is, they have that Clean Water Report Card, and it's not digging through, years, 25 years worth of individual reports. There's a way that you could, instead of reporting on every single thing, say, overall, our metrics say we've done, X, Y, and Z, and it's a nice snapshot, and it's a way that's the information is digestible, and it's not necessarily localized, but what's that overall impact to the state for habitat? And so those are things that are very difficult, and it's not just getting impact or feedback. It's how do we consolidate? What are those metrics? How do you collect those metrics? How do you represent them in a way that tells us what the change is and what the outcomes are, and so it's not just that kind of anecdotal, it's actually a measure, and that's hard. That's very, very difficult.
Thank you. Further discussion and thank you for your service to the council.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you.
And the process for putting together the RFP will go forward. Thank you. We'll move to item number six, the easement working group, and Chair Hartwell, please.
Great. Thank you. Well, your working group actually met and did our work. What else do you want to know? No, seriously, we had a meeting where we called in most of the people that have done easements with resources provided by the Legacy Amendment for a really interesting discussion on how they run their programs and the differences between their programs. And we gave them a set of questions in advance to prepare for so that there was consistency in the answers. You have in your packet LSOHC Partner Easement Program descriptions, and what you'll see is that Bowser, Minnesota Land Trust, Nature Conservancy with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Dakota County, DNR Trout Streams, and Forest, all came in and consistently reported on how they run their easement programs when it comes to how they do valuation, on how they do development prevention, how they handle building envelopes and such. And I think there's no question that everybody who came in had thought about the questions well in advance of us asking them. I mean, it wasn't like because we asked questions, they had some answers. These are all organizations that have programs that are really well thought out. There are differences between them, which is why we put it together. Mark has put it together with his staff that describe those differences in each area. There were no sort of aha moments of, you know, oh, my God, you mean you aren't really monitoring your easements? There are differences. Some believe you should monitor an easement every year and some every 5 years once they're established, and those are highlighted in this. But everybody who was there had well-thought-out programs, and they were able to articulate that. We've captured that. We've also provided some material that was supplied by Dakota County and others in response to the request for information. I think we felt, I certainly felt, we got the information we were asked to get by the council in this, and unless there is additional work that the council is interested in having us do, in which case we will do that, and I would be happy to stand for questions.
Thank you. Member Blackburn.
I don't have a question. I just have a comment. I was there, and again, my apologies, I was late. I had a meeting that went very late, so I was late, but I have listened to the tape for the 40 minutes that I wasn't there and reviewed all the material, including the legislative auditor's report on easements. And I think I understand a lot of the programs and a lot more, but of course, you know, sometimes with all of your learning, it just creates even more questions. So now, you know, good, bad, or otherwise, I probably have better questions to ask. The thing that I still don't quite have any comfort with is this whole issue of buildings. And, you know, with the Dakota Project, with the MLT Carnelian Creek project, those are things that had there not been circumstances where either we looked a little bit deeper or there was a change in the accomplishment plans, whether it's an extension or whatever it might be, we wouldn't have known about the Dakota County thing. Had I not looked at Carnelian Creek, we wouldn't have seen all those buildings there. I don't know what assurances we have about that. I mean, I hear folks say, you know, where it can't be, you know, where it can't be excluded, it will, you know, be allowed. I don't know what that means as far as our review of that, and that's where I have a little bit of nervousness. I don't know our way around that. I certainly don't have time to pay attention to every single, you know, easement that's been purchased and whether it's got a building or not. But that's my one thing where I'm still, I still am not quite settled on what the answers are to that, but or really the extent of it as an issue. I don't know. I know that I've had a couple of experiences that haven't been completely comfortable. It doesn't mean that anybody's doing wrong. It just means that I don't know whether if we knew all of that information, would we make different decisions?
Good. Member Tilley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does it make sense to develop some standard language we put in all of our grant agreements regarding all of these issues that we put our fingers on? The existing buildings, new buildings, trails, roads, fences, subdivision. Should there be a standard set of language that we include in each one of our development our contracts that will answer these questions for us and at least put our mind at ease into the future? We clearly can't go backwards, but into the future.
Member Hartwell.
I want to say I think that sounds great, but, you know, I was taken aback when, you know, we heard that Fish and Wildlife allows subdivision of easements. No buildings, but subdivision. And then they explained that, you know, they're managing a portfolio of thousands, hundreds of thousands of easements. And, you know, while it's a little more administrative burden to have three heirs own a tract of 100 acres instead of that it's divided into 33 acres each, they still don't allow buildings and nothing really changes. So where you see most easements don't allow that, they have a rationale for why they should do it differently and how it's worked for them. So I think to create a standard becomes really difficult, because what you've got is different organizations accomplishing the goals in different ways. With building envelopes, you know, I would tell you that where they are and how big they are and how big the whole parcel is an important part of that. And how do you standardize that you would only put a building envelope of this size on this size easement? You know, if it's a 1,000-acre easement and someone wants a 5-acre building envelope, I feel differently about it than a 10-acre building envelope on 30 acres. But I don't know what that point of ooh, I get uncomfortable is, and I think on some level we have to trust our partners to be making pretty good decisions on this. And I think if you'd sat through the presentation, you'll see that the deliberation that each of them are doing about each of the easements is not insignificant. I think it would be great to have standards, but I think practically it's very, very difficult to come up with consistent standards that would fit all circumstances. And what we'd end up doing is excluding projects that we don't want it, that we would like to do, because they don't meet the letter of the law that we've laid down. And we don't want to get into that game either. So I think that's a long answer to the question, but it really was clear how much thought everybody was putting into each of these projects as they did the work and thinking about it. Now, you know, Julie's concern, you know, how much is too much and what makes sense and all of that is, it's a legitimate concern. So I don't know. I'm inclined to say our partners are doing a pretty darn good job, and we ought to trust them to continue to do a good job, but have oversight so that if something jumps out, we're notified of that. And maybe the most contentious issue is building envelopes. Maybe we ask for reporting on that particular issue. So that if it becomes something that seems really outrageous, we can talk about it before it happens, and it goes to staff, and its staff can decide to elevate it if it's beyond what they're comfortable with. I don't know.
Your response, Member Tilley?
That does make a lot of sense. What if we had a set of goals that we expect people to ascribe to? And then as we make decisions on which grants we're going to recommend, we have a way of balancing on the, you know, two equal projects. One has no subdivisions, no buildings, no fences, no roads. The other has everything else the same, except they want to subdivide, they want to build building, build road. And we can decide whether we want to give the grant to this group or that group. Or is that just too much?
Well,
stuff for
I
the
think
staff
that's
to handle
easy to do for projects.
Right.
I think it's much more difficult to do for programs. I mean, if you were to look at Dakota County or the Land Trust or the forest projects, which aren't identified which parcels because it's a program they're going to go out and promote, how do you have them in
Good
advance?
Point. Good point. Yeah.
Say anything other than our goal is, but we aren't sure until we get there. Because the goal is all the same. Let's protect a whole bunch of habitat and have as little development on it as possible. But the circumstance, you know, means, and the beauty of easements are that you can somewhat dance around issues of existing things on the land and still protect the land. So it's really, when you get into it, it's really complex.
Thank you for all your hard work.
Member Scherer, thank you.
Member Hartwell, you're fond of more bang for the buck. Did you find, I know there are some organizations that get easements for a lot less money than others. As they came forward to you, any of them willing to change how they evaluate so that they get more bang for the buck, or is it written in stone or cement somewhere?
The more governmental, the more written in stone is what I would tell you. If you look at Bowser, they're using 90% of the crop rate and 60% of the non-crop rate of land value for permanent easements using a formula. And they'd tell you that that's how they do it and how they're required to do it. The land trust, on the other hand, is doing these reverse auctions and getting some that's donated 100% and some that they're having to pay fair market value for based on appraisals. Everybody's looking at it differently. And some are bound by bigger programs and mandates. Look at the easement value, the overview of easement valuation, which is the first bullet point on the descriptions, and you can see the diversity. I guess the question is sort of, do we want to set a limit, which we could do, of, we're not willing to spend more than 60% of appraised value and tell everybody they got to go get appraisals. That would exclude federal government easements because they don't work on appraisals. And it would exclude Bowser because they don't work on appraisals. We could say 60% of whatever your rate is and whatever your formula is, and that would exclude those that say they are required by law to pay more than that. So there becomes the dilemma.
Please. Thank you. I guess what I'm perplexed about is, it's not our duty to tell these agencies to get more bang for the buck. Perhaps using my money, they should be trying to get more bang for the buck themselves. And apparently that's not happening out there.
Well, I think we have the opportunity to say, if you're paying 90% of fair market value, we don't want to give you as much money as someone who's paying 60% of fair market value. And that's a decision that we get to make. The great part of easements is while you have an ongoing obligation to ensure compliance with the term of the easement, you don't have an ongoing obligation to manage the land, to pay property taxes. And so it's, in the long term, it does save you money to have easements over ownership. And that's the value of the easements. It keeps it keeps counties from saying you're taking land off the tax base. I mean, there are a lot of great benefits to easements. But the valuation thing is challenging. I mean, maybe with the new administration, they won't want to pay 90% of fair market value for term easements and set the value for what an easement is in the field, because it's not fiscally responsible to do that. But as long as the federal government wants to do that, it changes the valuation for everybody else.
Staff member Pavelko and then member Blackburn.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, I think if the council or certain council members have issues or don't like a certain part of a easement program, that you don't have to recommend funding. And so that's a way to take care of it. It sends a message if an applicant comes in and asks for money and they don't get it. And, it's specified that you don't like the way they're appraising the property or the building envelopes or something. That sends a message, and then the applicant would say, geez, well, maybe we do have to look at this because we're obviously not getting funding. So I think, you are sort of setting policy or, addressing this by how you allocate funds and how you vote, yes or no for different projects.
Thank you. Member Blackburn.
Well, I think that the easement valuation is just one component, and easements are a good tool. There are many good tools. There are reasons why we don't do easements, and there are very good reasons why we do easements. When you look at something like the Bowser program, which is particularly, you know, taking cropland out of production, which means, you know, which means something financially to that individual who is doing something for the greater good, you're taking money out of their ability to make an income. And there's a reason why that rate is the rate that it is. It's a little bit different. So I think to just look at it purely across a percentage or methodology, perspective is fairly narrow. And I also think it needs to be tied to the rest of the program that supports it. When you look at the prioritization, you know, whether it's a sign up, whether it's a reverse auction, whether it's whatever, I would say that you know, that the Bowser prioritization of how they rank their projects is stellar. And so we are getting the best of the best. We're taking land out of production in order to meet the end goals. And I think there's actually a premium for that. And I think that's very defensible. What we have to stay away from is just thinking that just one way is the right way, because, you know, there are so many different ways. There are many avenues. There's many on-ramps to get to conservation. And once we start limiting them with our perception of you know, what maybe sounds, in you know, not palatable for a rate, doesn't mean that it isn't maybe the best program going. There are other benefits. There are other ways to look at it. Prioritization is a key in it. I look at some of the prioritization in other areas that maybe aren't so expensive as far as their rate, and I don't know about whether that's good enough. So I don't want to be too restrictive, but I definitely think that there's reasons, and there's a lot that goes into the thought process of getting those in place.
Thank you. Further questions for Chair Hartwell of the easement working group? Thank you for your service and report on that.
Let me know if you want something else.
Very good.
But do read this over. It really is helpful.
And also, if anybody really wants to and has the time, maybe you want to listen to it on a drive or something. But the audio from that meeting is really informative, and it goes through, you know, all the different rates and the prioritization and how people fill out, you know, figure out their building envelopes. And it is long, but I mean, it's very informative, and the discussion's important and provides a lot more context than just, you know, reading a spreadsheet. So I'd encourage people to look at that or listen to that audio. It's right on our website.
Very good. Thank you. We'll move to item 7 on the agenda, and a presentation by Mr. Hickman.
Mr. Chair, members of the council, staff, I'm Don Hickman, Vice President with the Initiative Foundation. Thank you for allowing me a few minutes to update you on the evaluating strategies to prevent the spread of aquatic invasive species in Minnesota. I'm constantly aware that this is one of the more unorthodox grants you've supported, so while you're not being asked to take any actions today, I am appreciative of the opportunity to update you on our accomplishments and hurdles the past 12 months. Since July 2014, we've awarded approximately $846,000 in project support, matching funds to support varied strategies around the state, led by soil and water conservation districts, lake associations, county environmental staff, recreational departments, nonprofit organizations, and other local leaders. These projects have been as varied in strategy as they have been in location, but must include at least one major element that's unique or innovative with respect to the detection or management of AIS, providing inspection or decontamination services to recreationalists, promoting clean, drain, dry best management practices so that the message reaches those and changes the behavior of those who previously missed the message, or in financing and administrating activities so that they are more effective or more cost efficient. As you're aware, you've also helped support two aquatic invader summits in St. Cloud in January 2015 and October 2016. One of the key goals of these summits was to share the emerging and or successful activities, both those employed here in Minnesota and also across the country, and to establish and strengthen networks of the leaders so that they can explore and learn from one another, identify cost share or staff share opportunities, and generally come away with stronger networks to support this work. Ultimately, we want to be able to come back to you and assure you that you've supported the work you've supported is shared with the widest audience as possible. This past month, the Minnesota Lakes and Rivers Alliance was the host organization for that second summit. As you know, we're trying to essentially privatize these so that they will continue long after Lessard Sam's funds have expired. Council Director Mark Johnson was an attendee, and he'd suggested we might open our comments today with the following video, which was created by Wildlife Forever by Wired for Fish, and is intended to speak directly to the sportsmen's groups or other attendees of the summit.
The last glaciation blessed our Minnesota home with an abundance of water resources. These waters have shaped generations of Minnesotans into passionate users and stewards of the environment. The introduction and proliferation of aquatic invasive species has and is continuing to change aquatic environments and how we and nature coexist with them. Stewardship of nature is a responsibility of all of us. Let's work together to hand down a healthy tomorrow for future generations to protect and enjoy.
So Lessard Sam's funds were not used for that video, but I thought it spoke very well as to what and why we're supporting this work. And several of the projects you have supported were featured. If anything, this summit's this year's summit was stronger than the 2015 one. We had 343. Thank you. Who knows? I don't want to compete with you two. We had 343 total attendees from 65 counties, and the reviews of it were very strong. I've got a breakdown of who came, but between the careful management by Jeff Forrester of the Minnesota Lakes and Rivers Advocates, meaning that I was not the stage manager, and the even higher quality of presentations, I thought it was a fantastic summit. From a budget standpoint, the summits represent a very small fraction of your overall grant to us. We now have 10 active projects, and as I said, just under $1 million in state funds have been matched or exceeded by local sources. Ms. Brzee has a summary that I believe she circulated of the 10 active projects that we plan to continue till spring, June of 2019 with rigorous evaluation of the effectiveness of these projects, that we're clear on what was a good investment of dollars and not miss an infestation that we had failed to detect in the early stages of the program. I'm pleased to report that of all the projects that have reached the implementation stage, we have not detected any new infestations where you are working. One footnote to that is this past spring we made an award of $350,000 to the Wright County Soil and Water Conservation District as part of a comprehensive strategy to prevent the spread of AIS, to install a silk, or more accurately, a screen with apertures so small as to prevent the drift of villagers downstream, but large enough to not restrict water flow. And the goal, they had a headwater lake with that was known infested. The goal was to keep it from getting downstream. We approved the project before they got to sign the contract. They realized that area had been breached, so they had to tear up the contract. So the bad news is they had a good idea that we thought worth the investment. We didn't get there in time. But of the projects in implementation, that's not been the case. We've also had three other projects that have been aborted. Both the Cooks County Soil and Water Conservation District and the Minnehaha Creek Watershed District had submitted project proposals that were approved, but the Outdoor Heritage Council's funds were ultimately not awarded. In Cook County, the county commissioners decided they didn't want to participate in state funds. And the Minnehaha Creek Watershed District found that some of the local municipalities that they had hoped to serve with this project weren't willing to participate. One other project based in Candiohi County was canceled after a year of implementation. The environmental staff there had significant turnover. The project itself had not had quite the demand that the designers had anticipated, and so the county ultimately decided to pull the plug before the project had reached completion. On the upside of all our active projects, virtually everyone is an enthusiastic partner. At the Big Marine Carnelian Watershed, citizen leaders have engaged in an integrated pest management IPM strategy that was approved by DNR Fisheries of applying an herbicide to kill a known infestation of Eurasian water milfoil. It's the standard concentration, but rather than spread it out over time, they give three hits in a very short period of time, and it seems to exponentially increase the effectiveness. My understanding, it's been one of the most effective Eurasian water milfoil management programs ever. After two seasons, they have successful depression of these populations that have resulted in both an overall reduction in the herbicide applied and also, and more importantly, reduced the risk of the Eurasian water milfoil spreading to other lakes in the chain. I'm especially excited about a new project that's still in the development stage. The Cass County Association of Lakes has established a strong and respectful partnership with nearly 40 area resorts. And over the winter, the coalition is developing strategies to educate visitors to those resorts, many of which have private accesses. And the COLA will sponsor community inspections, and the resorts will educate their guests. There'll be an award for the great best resort stewardship. I'm just thrilled that we've got these uncommon bedfellows, or folks who've not worked together in the past, suddenly seeing their common cause. I also want to express my appreciation to the staff at the Department of Natural Resources. We continue to find smarter ways to work together, and they've welcomed our preliminary findings as well as the lessons learned of some of our projects that didn't go as we expected, and are exploring ways to streamline the regulatory review they require of our program participants. There are several times where I've learned of bumps from our projects from Heidi, and rather than just criticize them, she's reflected on ways the DNR can work even more effectively, both with our projects and also in their long-term strategy. In closing, I'd like to call out a deviation from our original proposal to the Outdoor Heritage Council. 3 years ago, the citizen advocacy groups, the Minnesota Coalition of Lake Associations, and the Minnesota Lakes and Rivers Advocates were incredibly effective at seeking financial support from the state of Minnesota for the AIS prevention and management. And Jeff Forrester and Joe Schneider are here representing those groups. In response to this advocacy, we had promised you that we would do our best to get all the project funds from this grant out to support projects in the first 2 years of implementation. That's gone, and in the last 3 years, because this goes to June 2019, we would only be evaluating what we had funded. The money's gone out a lot slower than we thought. One factor was the legislative-approved county aid money, the $10,000 that goes directly to local units of government. And the other factor is, frankly, a lot of our partners aren't used to the bureaucracy required through this process. And so it's been slower to gear up than we expected. At this point, I believe we're seeing stronger proposals than ever. And so I wanted to call your attention to our intent to continue to support projects for at least one more year, which still leaves us 2 years of evaluation. And again, in many respects, our promise to you was out of respect to pressure from these two advocacy groups. And I know part of the reason both gentlemen are here is to express their support for continuing to invite new projects. With that, I'd welcome any questions you have.
Thank you. Questions? Member Hartwell.
I don't have a question. I just want to thank you for taking on a project. Those of you who weren't here, we were receiving some legislative encouragement to be involved in the AIS issue, and we included it in our criteria. We got two or three proposals, none of which were very exciting, and the council rewrote a proposal and asked the initiative fund to bring it forth and to try this approach. I think it's been more difficult than what you expected, and I'm just deeply appreciative that you took on the task and you stayed with it, and you've got former adversaries as part of your program that are supporting it. You've done a great job in a very tough field with very few great answers, so thank you for the work.
Thank you for the kind words.
Thank you. Member Kingston.
I'm not kind, I want to preface what I have to say to make sure that everybody realizes it's not directed at the Initiative Foundation or at Jeff Forrester's work or anybody who's doing AIS work. It's not at the value of the work. It does need to be done. But my big deal here is that this is so far from constitutional that it gives me the heebie-jeebies, and it was a mistake. It was something that we did in response to pressure that had nothing to do with habitat and what the function of our council is. We do not fund research or education or experimental work, and that's what's going on. It's a mistake, it's an aberration, and I exhort everybody to not use it as a precedent. Again, it doesn't have anything to do with the value of the work. It has to do with the appropriateness of these funds and what they're for. And that's the drum I'm going to keep beating over and over again, because this is bizarre for what this council is supposed to be doing, not the value of the work. I hope everybody understands what I'm saying.
Thank you. Further questions for Mr. Hickman? Member Scherer.
Thank you. Appreciate the effort out there, too. I run into a lot of folks standing at the boat accesses. I'm a little perplexed, however, because sometimes I think our preventive measures are ahead of the science. unless something else has happened of late, I don't think we still know how zebra mussels are transported. And so without knowing that, do we really know if we're stopping them? And then the other thing, I'm perplexed. I'm up in the Woman Lake chain where the rusty crayfish has taken over. And Member Kingston, contrary to your thought about habitat, the rusty crayfish has destroyed fish habitat up there. And so control of the rusty crayfish would improve the fish habitat. But what I'm perplexed about is that the trappers up there, the rusty crayfish trappers, tell me they could annihilate the rusty crayfish in Woman Lake if they, if somebody wanted them to do it without having to worry about market forces, because they try to sell them. If they didn't have that, they tell me they could really put a huge dent in the rusty crayfish in the Woman Lake chain, which also includes Leech Lake. But I don't see our DNR doing that, going to gathering trappers and saying, hey, go get the rusty crayfish, let's knock the hell out of them. And so I go, why aren't we doing that?
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Griffin, thank you.
So to speak gently to the comments of both members, I'm very cognizant of your concerns, and of course that's been a concern from the beginning. I believe the council justified your investment by saying that if we fail to prevent the spread of AIS, we are failing to preserve habitat, and it really is an obligation. But that's part of why I'm here, because I realize I'm at the very edge of comfort zone. Mr. Shara, one of the projects we are supporting is in Lake County, and we do have a bounty on rusty crayfish, and it's been incredibly successful. They have a weekly rusty crayfish roast and prizes for the recipes, and they have seen a significant depression in the population. This won't be sustained for a long time, but it has absolutely changed the conversation because we are literally supporting the innovative or unique activities. I have discouraged anyone who says that worked, now let's scale it up to state. We're only meant to shine in the light on what might work without doing original research. And then if the science can back that up over the long haul, DNR or other partners can extrapolate, can scale, can develop policy based on what we learn. We are not allowed to fund research. That's been a frustration with our friends at the Aquatic Invasive Species Research Center. Yet Peter Sorensen is on our committee. We're in constant contact with all the scientists there, so we're not funding bad projects or projects contrary to good science. It is an edgy and gray area. That's where this project lives.
Further questions for Mr. Hickman? Very good. Thank you very much for your time and for your efforts, sir. We'll take a break until 10 o'clock and then resume. Thank you. Eddie, we're going to take a 20-minute break here. All right. Can we come back to session, please? Thank you. In readjourning, we will go to item number 8 on the agenda, and that's a presentation on ATV trails. Mr. Ray Bone and Laura.
Laura Price.
Price. Thank you. Mr. Bone, I'll turn it over to you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the council, thanks for inviting me here today, and thanks for allowing us to be here. We'd like to do is basically present to the council our thoughts on, you know, where we've been, where we are now, and give you some idea of what we have to go through to get a designated trail on the ground. It's not just something that we decide we want a trail and we put it on. You know, it's obviously become very intricate. I just would like to say that everything we talk about today, we've worked very closely with DNR and the counties in a cooperative fashion. We've obviously, it was a give and take. We've agreed to things like, for example, increased penalties, confiscation of machines in the worst case where wetlands are being damaged. We've agreed to walking trails where we're excluded for hunting. So there are a number of things where we've worked very cooperatively with the DNR. In fact, in our Gilbert, in our off-highway vehicle park in northern Minnesota, we actually closed it down for ATV recreation during deer hunting, and we opened it up to the deer hunters. That's an agreement we made with them. So I think, you know, I would like to say in my experience, the group that I represent is a very responsible group of ATV recreational riders. They have attempted, as long as I've worked with them, to do the right thing, and I think we've done a lot of things right. I'm sure we've made mistakes, and we'll probably continue to make some mistakes along the way. But I believe we've made some significant progress in the last 15 or the 20 years, over 20 years that I've been working with them. So what I'd like to do today, rather than you listening to me, I'd like to hear it directly from the horse's mouth, so to speak. George Radke, who is with the All-Terrain Vehicle Association of Minnesota, ATVAM, will be here and talking about his experience. George has started out with trail development as a snowmobiler and now is very much involved in ATV trail development. And then also we've asked DNR if they would come and help us explain what the process is for trail development on public land. So with that, maybe Laura, if you want to come up, and I'll just take a back seat here.
Yeah, Karen.
Oh, Karen. Okay. We also, I didn't know if she was going to be here or not. Karen Umphress, who is with ARMPA, which is the Amateur Riders Motorcycle, the dirt bikers. She's kind of the expert trail person, so we've asked her to be also give a short presentation. Now, we've asked each of them to give about 10 minutes, so that would leave about a half hour for questions, and we hope that we can kind of establish a dialogue with you and answer any questions that you may have about what it is and who we are and what it is that we do. So thank you very much again. Karen?
Thank you. So we'll hear from the
we'll start out with George.
We'll hear the presentations, and then we will have questions at the end.
Okay. Thank you. Very good. Like Ray had said, my name is George Radke. I'm the president of the All-Terrain Vehicle Association of Minnesota. I've been involved with ATVing in the state of Minnesota since about 2000. Like Ray had mentioned, I'm an avid snowmobiler, have been since the 60s. We've seen a need, basically, myself personally, to get involved, partially from a conservation standpoint. So that being said, I want to thank you all for allowing us to come and speak with you today about motorized trails in the state of Minnesota. The one thing I need to make a point of is that at one point in the mid-1980s, our legislature had made a policy decision to allow ATVs on state and public lands in the state of Minnesota. So we became part of the environment when it came to recreation. ATVs back in the 90s, we had a lot of issues, just like the snowmobilers did back in the 70s, caused a lot of consternation, anger, damage to public properties. We do understand where we came from in reference to that, and there were a lot of issues. And that's part of the reason why ATVAM has gotten involved in this from that perspective. ATVAM's worked diligently with the DNR and our legislatures back in the 90s and the 2000s in particular to come up with rules and regulations to deal with these bad actors and some of these issues in relation to the off-trail travel and wetland destruction and the different things like this, and to come up with ways to establish trail systems that are sustainable, environmentally sustainable, as far as that's concerned, and to give the ATV recreationists in this state some place where they can ride. Please do understand, there are almost 300,000 registered recreational ATVs in the state of Minnesota, which almost doubles the number of riders. We're talking close to 500,000 people in the state of Minnesota that recreate on ATVs. I think under the circumstances, we've done an absolutely fabulous job working with the DNR and with our counties and our stakeholders, our communities, to try to get people back on the places where they belong. That being, trails are part of the solution. They're not the problem. Trails give people places to ride where they belong, where they can be maintained and sustained and organized. instead of riding helter-skelter wherever they please and causing the destruction that they had in the past. Like Ray said, yes, we do have our downfalls when it comes to it. We have a footprint that is probably more destructive than most. So because of that, we have a bigger job to do to try to maintain that. The other thing that ADFAM has done, I believe, working with the DNR, is that we've been extremely successful with education. Since the onset of ATV safety training, we've probably trained about 45,000 students. Just in 2016 alone, we had about 4,000 students that were trained in ATV and OHM education. And a big part of our education program is talking about sustainable trails, conservation, riding where you belong, and abiding by the laws that are put in place, or you will lose your rights to ride. And it's starting to work. It really, truly is. Just the same way as it has worked with firearm safety. So some of the other things that we're involved with, ADFAM got involved with some years ago and pushed very hard, was the Trail Ambassador Program. This is an on-trail education program where we spend time on trails. We monitor ourselves. We monitor our riders. We make sure they stay where they belong. We watch for environmental issues, everything from working with Play Clean Go. We work on identifying terrestrial invasive species and help to eliminate them in reference to that. And that's not just from ATVers either. This is from white walkers, bikers, hikers, and equestrians. So we don't just ride on our trails. We share our trails. And a great many of our trails are shared amongst more than just motorized. So this program with the Trail Ambassadors has provided everything from on-trail education to riders to assistance, emergency assistance, giving directions, handing out maps, and just in general talking about what the riders' expectations are and understanding their experience and what are they looking for in a trail system here in Minnesota. ATVAM works diligently with our local clubs that provide support for our trail systems here in Minnesota. In relation to that, also with the DNR, our counties, and our communities. The other thing that I need to bring up is that ATVAM, over the course of the years that I've been involved as the president of ATVAM, has never really asked our DNR and our others in relation to our recreation is to be treated any differently. We need to ask just one thing, to be treated like anybody else and not to be excluded. When we first started talking to the legislature about what Lessard Sams is doing in relation to conservation, we were assured at that point that we were not going to be cut out of this, that trails, from a motorized perspective, were still on the table. They were never going to be gone. Or I guarantee you we would have fought to stop that or to change that. That's part of the reason why we're here today. We need to make sure that we don't get cut out just because we don't recreate in the same fashion as everybody else does. The motorized environment or the motorized community is very big in the state of Minnesota. ATVing is one of the largest growing recreational sports, getting our children out into the recreate outdoors and getting them away from their TV sets and their video games. This is something that's important to me as a grandfather and a father. I have 11 grandchildren. And we recreate together. We hunt, we fish, and primarily that's what we do the most of. But we also recreate with motorized, both ATVs and snowmobiles. So with kind of where I've kind of led this to at this point, what I'd like to do now is kind of turn this over to Karen. Karen is fabulous when it comes to understanding our processes and what we actually have to go through before we actually put a trail on the ground today. There's a whole lot of trail systems in the state of Minnesota. I guess I wouldn't call them trail systems. I would actually call them riding opportunities that were in our state forests. When we went through phase one with the DNR, we had thousands of miles of opportunities that we used to ride that were shut down because they were not sustainable, and we supported this. This is something that ATVAM supported. we're in the process of going through phase two and looking at these all again, because some of them that got shut down maybe shouldn't have been, or there should be other options with some of these things. We're just looking for places to put our riders where they belong and where it's sustainable. Karen?
Thanks. My name is Karen Umfress. I'm with the Amateur Riders Motorcycle Association. It operates as District 23 of the American Motorcyclist Association. Thanks so much for allowing us to be here today. I'm actually going to start with a story, because I have a good friend who lives in Montana, and he and a bunch of his friends got together and bought the recreational rights for a ranch. It's called Bull Run Guest Ranch, and it's got 13,000 acres of land. And this particular area is known for two things: off-highway vehicle recreation and hunting. I've been out there several occasions. I've seen a herd of over 200 elk, so many bold mule deer that you can, they just stop and they watch you and they don't run away. It has antelope, it has bear, it has bighorn sheep, it has a lot of wildlife, and anytime you're on the myriad of trails that are there, you have the opportunity to view these wildlife. And unless you get off and have a gun, they don't run away. Now, if you get off, they're going to think that you're stalking them or hunting them, and then they do run away. But off-highway vehicle recreation, for the most part, is not detrimental or bars wildlife from coexisting. And I have several other anecdotal stories that I can tell in a couple of studies. But for what I want to talk about today is off-highway vehicle recreation in Minnesota. And across the country and in Minnesota, off-highway vehicle recreation is pay-to-play. That means we put forth money that maintains and builds, and we put forth the volunteer hours that maintain and build the trail systems that we have here in Minnesota. The first part is called the Recreational Trails Program, and that is a federal program that's the gas tax that's not refunded to agricultural, and it's collected from off-highway vehicles. And a small portion of that is distributed across the country in set formulas. Minnesota gets part of that. That's federal money. In the state, we also have the non-refunded gas tax from the state taxes that are collected for off-highway vehicle recreation. That money can be matched. It's also any registration. One of the interesting things about the Recreational Trails Program is that although the money comes from off-highway vehicle recreation, 30% goes to non-motorized recreation, and 40% goes to a combination of both motorized and non-motorized recreation. So in the state of Minnesota, only 30% of that money that's from off-highway vehicle gas taxes actually goes specifically to off-highway vehicle recreation. As George mentioned, not every trail or trail opportunity that's out there is sustainable. There's a lot of literature that's been created about how to create an off-highway vehicle trail that's sustainable and well-managed, including, start with the bottom, the Minnesota DNR, in cooperation with the Motorized Trail Coalitions in Minnesota, wrote this book. It's a national seller. It sold from American Trails, and it also won an award for its ability to plan any type of trail system in the state, whether it's motorized or non-motorized. The U.S. Forest Service's Comprehensive Guide to Off-Highway Vehicle Management, the short version, Off-Highway Vehicle Management Guidelines, Park Guidelines for Urban Off-Highway Vehicle Parks, and last but not least, the new guide that's also award-winning and nationally recognized, which is Anything You Need to Know to Plan, Design, Construct, Maintain, and Manage an Off-Highway Vehicle System. So there's best practices, and there's guidelines that we use. In the state of Minnesota, there requires a cooperation in order for an off-highway vehicle trail system to go in. That cooperation is with a local stakeholder group, a local unit of government, and the Department of Natural Resources. All three of those components go together to create a trail system. In the early stages of planning, all divisions of the Department of Natural Resources have the opportunity to comment and view the area that is going to become or could become an off-highway vehicle trail system. So wildlife is viewed, the ecology, the invasive natural species, cultural areas, historical areas. All of those are reviewed prior to any trail being designed or laid out on the ground. They're reviewed at the area level, and then they're reviewed again at the regional level. And if there's any showstoppers in any of that, the trail system doesn't go in, or we find ways to work around to protect the natural resources. Best management practices are guide. We use a process that adheres to all of the recommendations of the Environmental Quality Board. Sometimes we even go a step extra. In general, you only need 10 miles of new trail to need an environmental assessment worksheet. However, in general, even if the trail system is not 10 miles, on an initial trail system, we will recommend an EAW is performed. We'll do an environmental impact statement when they're required as well. The grants that I've talked about, the grant and aid system, almost every off-highway motorized trail system in the state goes through what's called a grant and aid or Minnesota Trails Assistance Program, and there's a 7-step process. And I believe Laura is going to explain the process in detail. The biggest portion of the process is the planning, and that's step zero. So the planning comes prior to any of the trail maintenance, the layout, the construction, or even the agreement for the trail system. All of the grant and aid trails are done through the system. They're reviewed annually to make sure that they're working, to make sure that everybody's still happy with them, the trails are maintained, the local unit of government is still supportive, and none of the sustainability requirements have been eroded. If at any point in time in this entire process something isn't working, then we all have the ability to go back to the drawing board and find out how to change it, how to fix it, using, again, the best practice management practices that are set down. We have processes. We're very conscientious of the natural environment. The reason why we're on the trails is because we love the natural environment and we want to be out in it. It's not our goal to destroy it. It's not our goal to destroy the wildlife. We've taken a lot of time to create these processes and would like to be able to continue to use them. So at this point, I'm going to turn this over to Laura Preuss from the Department of Natural Resources, and she can explain the 7-step process in detail.
Hello. My name is Laura Preuss. I'm the Policy Programs and Planning Manager with the DNR's Division of Parks and Trails. Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I will be talking about DNR management of ATV trails and cover a number of points. Some of them relate to some items that George and Karen already mentioned, but I wanted to share some of this from DNR perspective. The types of trails that we manage related to ATV trails are both on state lands and grant and aid trails. And the state trails, most of these are on our state forest lands. Forest for the Future easements is another area where we have state trails. And WMAs, SNAs, AMAs generally don't have trails. There are some exceptions as it relates to big game retrieval in the northwest WMAs and things like that. But the WMAs, SNAs, AMAs generally don't have ATV trails. And our state forests are where we find most of them. And, you know, it's important, I think, to think about the range of state lands that we have. All of those lands are important for habitat in different ways, and they also have different ways that we manage and use ATV trails on them with a lot of attention that we put to that. We have 59 state forests in the state with different classification levels, and those have also been mentioned. And many of you, I really believe, are familiar with this, but I think it's a good reminder, and it might be a helpful resource. Thank you, Amanda. To just remind ourselves of how far we have come in thinking about how we manage our trails, motorized trails, on our state forests. So we have a set of different types of classifications, and the handout that you're receiving gives some definitions for that as a resource for you. Managed state forest lands limited state forest lands and closed state forest lands. And this handout simply shows the range of forests that we have under those. And those guide specifically how and when we can use ATVs in these state forest lands. Again, I know many of you are familiar with this, but I think it does illustrate the comprehensiveness to which we think about how we manage state trails and also how these have been guided by statute. Another point that I'd like to make about our state forest lands is that they are third-party certified for sustainable forest management. And this is it's a big accomplishment for Minnesota. And during that third-party audit process, we look at things like, or the third-party auditor looks at things like timber harvest, biodiversity and habitat, recreational use, and more, in order to come up with that assessment that this does indeed meet the merits of being a sustainable forest management. So that's another point that I wanted to bring up about that, because it illustrates the integration of how we think about our work with a variety of factors and habitat and trail use. I've mentioned our state lands. Karen also spoke about our grant and aid program. DNR also manages and administers that program that is really a partnership program. We are currently working with 36 counties, townships, and local government sponsors and clubs for these grant and aid ATV trails. Our grant and aid program really has specific procedures and requirements in place. This can be found on our website, and it really lays out the process and requirements. So there are specific things that must be met in order to become a grant and aid trail, and it's really quite stringent. Karen mentioned this, and I do have a handout. We're not sure the level of detail that we want to go in with all of you. If you would like this, it's perhaps available. But let me just, at a fairly high level, describe to you and illustrate the extensiveness of this process. You know, there's first the initial conception and considering of a trail. Then we also work closely together within all parts of DNR. So there's a lot of review that must take place in order for a grant and aid trail to be designated. And this includes interdisciplinary review. It includes an area and regional review. And, you know, maybe this is helpful just since I'm speaking to it. Thank you, Amanda. And so there's an extensive review process that takes place, including all parts of DNR who may have an interest in looking at different features. And so after the review process, there's also public input opportunities and notification. We ensure that the necessary environmental review takes place. As Karen mentioned, sometimes there's even going a step further, but we always cover our bases with any necessary EAWs and environmental review that must take place. Then we can approve the grant, and then we look at project permitting, and then importantly, maintenance, ensuring that this trail is well managed and well maintained, as well as inspection and monitoring over time. So there's quite an extensive process to ensure that these trails are well managed and well placed. I also want to reference that even though today's focus is on ATV trails, the DNR manages a wide scope of trails. And Karen mentioned this, but also this trail planning design and development guidelines that was developed in 2006 to provide really some common principles for managing for quality recreational trails. And it really provides a framework for planning for sustainable trails. And I think part of the point here is that whether trails are ATV trails, mountain biking trails, equestrian trails, hunter walking trails, we're looking at systems of trails and how we effectively manage them. And we need some common guidelines and principles, and we do have those in best management practices in place. Because we know that trails are a great benefit for the citizens of Minnesota. This is a way for us to get connected to the outdoors. This is where we get some of our access to hunting and trapping. And so, you know, all of us use and benefits from trails, and there's a spectrum of them that we must pay attention to and manage, and we're really trying hard to hit that balance of how we manage our trails. So I'd like to sum up to just maybe hit home some of the points about the level of requirements and procedures that we go through related to designating and managing trails. We have requirements, sets of requirements in place by statute, rule, and procedure. We have significant review, interdisciplinary review that takes place where we have the opportunity to look at habitat, sensitive natural areas, hydrologic systems, and more, purpose, fit, use of the trail before it's placed and built, and then also ensuring environmental review when needed. We also have active management. And so once a trail is there, how do we think about how we're managing it to be well maintained over time? We can do temporary and seasonal closures as needed. For example, in the spring until the trails firm up, or we can close trails for hunting, with the exception of licensed hunters. And so there's a number of tools that we have in the toolbox to think about temporary closures if needed, or getting in and fixing something if needed, and more. Also, enforcement and training play a big role here. Again, those were referenced by George and Karen. Those are critical aspects of this trail system, and we're really trying to promote more training and understanding of how we're ensuring effective trails. And then one key point, too, around the level of investment that we make. Karen mentioned a couple of programs. For the ATV fund, for example, that's funded by gas tax and user fees, we have a little over $2 million that the Parks and Trails spends on managing ATV trails and ensuring that they're managed well. A little over $2 million also goes to enforcement to ensure that we're enforcing those trails and making sure that we're hitting the mark on that. And then a little over $1 million that goes towards grant and aid to work with local communities and volunteers to manage these trails well. So we have a significant investment in doing this and doing it well. And so with all that, I think that part of what we're saying here is that we have a spectrum of lands, and DNR is viewing habitat and trails as compatible when we're able to design, plan, and manage them well. And that's something that we're really working hard to do. We think it's important to work in partnership. As George and Karen mentioned, ATVAM has been working very hard at this. We've been trying to work with ATVAM, working with local communities, clubs, local government sponsors, with bodies such as yourselves. So there's really a partnership role for all of us. And I think in the last decade, we have come really, really far as advancing a system of managed use on managed trails. And so we take that very seriously. So that's all I have on DNR's portion of it. And thank you for the time to present today.
Thank you, Laura. All right, we'll open it up to questions for George or Karen or Laura. Member Tilley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I don't know who's the most appropriate one to answer this, but I'm curious about the easement that was purchased with Lessard Sam funds early in the cycle of Lessard Sam's of the Blandon property. How is that property, is that able to be accessed with ATVs or trails? I know the easement allows people to hunt there, but explain to me how that easement works as it relates to trails and ATVs.
Are you talking about Mississippi Northwoods?
No, the Blandon.
I'm sorry. I don't want to go there either, but that's why I need to ask.
So,
oh, let's talk about it. We might have to go there, but let's go. Let's answer your question.
So I can jump in for a little bit. You're speaking to the Blandon lands, and I don't know extreme specific details on that one, so I'll have to ask for backup from Grant and others, or if we need to get back to you from some additional information. But my understanding is that on a lot of those lands, there was ATV trail use, a lot of hunting and types of opportunities that took place on those lands. And when we acquired those easements, that recreational use was viewed as an important part of that. And so there is ATV use on some of those easements, and that's a part of sort of the whole set of understanding what was important about acquiring those easements was for habitat and recreational access.
Just to follow up, are trails on those easements marked, or do you just have to know where they are? Is there a way for the public to know?
Sure. We mark trails, and so I would say that they are marked.
Thank you.
Yes, the executive director.
Mr. Chair and members, just to let you know, I did speak with I can picture her now, and I can't remember her name, Ed Blandon, anyway, Gellin, their lead forester and ecologist. And I have a copy of the trails policy. I'll forward that to the council and get that out this week to you. Their trails are, it's only their hard roads. They don't have, and designated trails alone, and all of them are marked. There's no cross-country travel, no use for your ATV going in to pull a deer out or whatever. It's strictly those designated trails, and they like it. As I understand from them, also the conservation officers in the county really like it too.
Thank you.
Representative Lilly, then Member Kingston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a question for the DNR. So I'm not an animal biologist, but pretty close to here we have a park in the city of Oakdale, and they've had to hire hunters to come in there and shoot deer, and because there's just so many of them, and there's roads all over, there's trails paved, and tons of walkers and bikers. So I guess my question is, I'm always confused, because apparently the animals must have different biology outstate. Because if you put a trail in one of these forests or land, for some reason they won't breed or they won't reproduce. So what happens in the rural Minnesota that I don't understand? Because in the metro, we have to hire hunters to come in. there's an example. I was told recently at a family gathering a story of this lady, one of the snipers that were in there, you know, the bow hunters was in one of these areas hunting and shot a big buck. And this lady comes running out, and she starts, hey, you. And the guy is kind of scared, thinking this lady might be mad, but after he dropped this big buck, and she says she was thanking him profusely because she couldn't keep him out of her garden. So it was not exactly his response. So my question is, just being, you know, not the biologist or whatever, what happens outstate Minnesota with the animals? Why won't they breed? Why won't they, you know, if there's a ATV that goes by, you know, we have cars that go by in the metro, we have tons of, you know, the Gateway Trail, one of the busiest trails in the state of Minnesota. There's tons of deer and turkey around there. And there's horses, there's paved trail, there's cars. What happens? Because I just don't get it. So can you explain to me why we can't have trails on any of this land? Because God help us, the animals just will not breed.
Can I phone a friend? No, there's a lot wrapped into that question, Mr. Chair and members. So, you know.
Rollerbladers, too.
What's that?
I'm kidding. Rollerbladers as well.
Yeah. I mean, if we're asking about, you know, habitat use, trails, where, you know, certainly there is a variety of distribution around the state in how we think about trails and the density of trails and so on. And when it comes to breeding patterns of specific animals, you know, that's, I mean, we go to great length to try to understand those patterns around the state if we look at, you know, deer and more. So I think we'd have to get down to specific populations if we were going to answer that more broadly.
Thank you. Member Kingston.
I have anecdotes, too. I mean, I think everybody does. Working in the mining industry, it was when, you know, 25 years ago, that I'm old, when bald eagles were still relatively rare, that the Bald Eagle Protection Act, in addition to the Migratory Species Act, prohibited any activity around the nesting area, you know, when that nesting season goes on from February to May or whenever the little guys leave the nest. And they built their nest 100 yards from a major haul road, 240-ton production trucks hauling. And you're right, as long as the traffic keeps moving, and that's not the only anecdote, as long as you don't stop and, God forbid, roll down your window and they smell you, you know, that's what does the trick. But they're the ones who located, and that's because their population rebounded enough so that they were looking for marginal habitat. When there's superior habitat, it doesn't have that stuff. And there are certain species that, you know, deer, skunks, raccoons, crows, et cetera, coyotes that do very well living right outside your front door. And it has to do with specific populations and habitat availability. And I'm not a biologist either, but I think we really need a wildlife biologist to come and present why and how trails do impact them. So anecdotes aside, I live 4 miles away from the Gilbert OHV Park. It's a great facility. We need more of them in the state. I have 2 Jeeps. I like to ride. I have relatives that are trail riders, bikes, and ATVs. I don't need to get on a vehicle. I need to walk more personally. I don't need to sit here the way I am. I need to get out and move around. And you guys who are testifying here today are the good guys. There's no doubt about it. All that being said, my question, sitting in this chair today on this council and for my duration of my term, is how does trail riding restore, protect, enhance wetlands, prairies, forests, and habitat for fish, game, and wildlife? How does trail riding enhance it? How does it protect it? How does it restore it? That's the disconnect, and that's where we're coming from. I'm not trying to establish a whole new regime of rules. Whatever DNR does in state parks and through their grants and aid program, we're a little tail of the little dog, and what we do is put money for wildlife, game and fish habitat. That's the disconnect. So please don't misunderstand that we don't get it, but I want the viewpoint from the other side telling how trail riding does affect populations to answer your serious question. Thank you.
If I may address that, Chair and members, not all of the detail is anecdotal. There have been studies on how off-highway vehicle recreation does affect wildlife. The foremost one was done in Oregon, where they not only tagged deer, but they also measured their heart rate and their blood pressure to see how any type of trail user or a person affected them. And the study found that if there was a non-motorized recreation that was silent, like a hiker or some person like that, even mountain bikes for a certain amount, the deer did not run as soon. They were more startled, and they ran farther. So the people were sneaking up on them because they couldn't hear them in advance. It startled them. They were people, and they ran farther, and they were more stressed. So the heart rate increased a lot, and the blood pressure went up. For an off-highway motorcycle or ATV, what happened was the deer would hear them far enough advance, so they moved sooner, but they never moved as far, and the heart rate and the blood pressure did not increase nearly as much. So it was very mild. There's another study of, I can't remember the name of the bird, but it's a black-winged bird down in Texas that's endangered. And they do counts for where this bird is and how it's faring. And the last two counts that happen every 3 years, the counts in the off-highway motorized recreation area, called an Escondido Draw Recreation Area, the counts increased, so the bird did well. And everywhere else in the state of Texas, the counts for that particular bird decreased. So there are studies and examples out there as to where it does have a less effect for off-highway motorized recreation.
Just to follow up on that, I'm not discussing the compatibility or lack of compatibility of the activities, and we're not here to eliminate hunting either, by the way. But how does trail riding restore, protect, and enhance wetlands, prairies, and forests for fish, game, and wildlife? That's my question, and I don't think you're the ones to answer it. For all the credit that I give you, I think there's a flip side, and I think we need to hear the flip side. Thanks a lot.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm trying to get at some facets of your question. I'm not a wildlife biologist, but I do have my graduate degree in conservation biology. And like many of us at DNR, we try to understand the many aspects of our environment. And so that point that there are instances where there may be effects, and so where do we understand them and try to avoid those is critical and key. There may be other instances where there aren't that much of an effect. And so part of our charge is understanding those distinctions and managing them well. And so I think that there's a situation here where we're understanding that for certain types of lands, we really take special care for avoiding things. Other lands, they may have greater use. They all have importance depending on the situation. And so we strive to ensure in those places that have special types of habitat or special types of species that we're avoiding it as we can, and that we're managing and placing and designing them well. And so we're looking at instances where we can say we believe that this is compatible, and if it's not compatible, then let's not have it there.
And I understand your question where you're not talking about compatibility, but how a trail system can actually improve the natural habitat. And to that, I'm going to point to the Recreational Trails Program, and also when we're designing a trails program, we look at what the natural environment is or what it should be. So, for example, there's an area in Renville County that we're working, and the area was extensively mined, and we're looking at putting in the possibility of an off-highway vehicle trail system. And part of the design is where trails will not be restoring the actual prairie that was there prior to the mining. So sometimes when we build the trails and we use the grant money from off-highway vehicle registrations and gas tax, we actually improve the environment that surrounds the trail system and the trail area. So putting in a trail system can improve the natural environment.
Part of the other thing is, too, is like I had mentioned from the beginning, trails become part of the solution. They're not part of the problem. Really what you're thinking about also, too, from a conservation perspective, people ride ATVs today. And like I talked about, back in the earlier times, we pretty much rode wherever we pleased, and we did whatever damage we pleased. In the process of that, by putting in a trail system that's maintained and sustainable, it becomes part of a conservation movement in that aspect, because we're putting people where they belong and not taking them and putting them and allowing them to ride wherever they want. And I'll be really honest with you, and maybe this is more of a question than a statement, but from a conservation perspective, if what you want is a WMA, then have a WMA. If you want a state forest and you want to conserve this property so it cannot be developed, turned into a housing development, so be it. There's going to be recreation on it, and from that perspective, the motorized community is only asking one thing. If there's going to be recreation on this property, treat us the same as everyone else. And that's all we ask at that point. So I guess it's more of a question in that sense than a statement. Is what we're looking for here is preservation or conservation? We teach our children, as a firearm safety instructor, the difference between conservation and preservation. Conservation is the wise use. Preservation is not using it at all. So we need to figure out which way are we going with this. You know, from my perspective as well, I'm confused. What is the goal? From conservation or is it preservation?
Thank you. Member Scherer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Speaking for myself, there's no anti-trail mentality here, because trails have a place. And I think trails even could be construed as some habitat in some cases. But I think where the problem lies is that, well, trails are probably not as important to the wildlife population as how the land is managed. You know, clear cuts or whatever we're doing with the forest or whatever. So trails probably play a minimal role in their impact on wildlife. But as we sit here, when you secure a piece of nice property and then you also think it's open to the public and how they will use it, what you have to, I think, admit is that your presence probably overrules the enjoyment of some other people who are on that same piece of property, because they're not making noise like an engine, they're not roaring by, they're walking, etc. And so, you know, I worry about the density of the trails in some piece of property. And I think we have some examples where that density, we were misled about the density of the trails. So it's not an anti-trail sentiment here, at least speaking for myself, but it's a kind of a concern. Even though, you know, we're in charge of habitat and securing it, etc., you can't get away from the fact that it's open to the public and people are using it. And so how are they impacted if we don't have some concern about the other uses on that land? Am I making any sense?
Mm-hmm. Very much so.
That's rare.
Thank you. Other questions for our presenters? Member Hartwell.
So I just have to say, because I get what Leon is saying. There are species of wildlife that do really well on edge, in what we would define as edge. Robins are one of them. You can't chase them away practically. There are other species that don't do so well. And the question really is, in a functioning ecosystem, how do you have a balance so that you have both the species that live on the edge and the species that live in the less disturbed areas, and not disturb them, so that they will breed and use and feed and all of the other things. It's not just about breeding; it's about where they feed and so it's a very complex issue, and we know that fragmentation, in general, is not good for wildlife overall. It's very good for some wildlife. And so the issue with trails is, where are they located? How can they minimize the fragmentation of a habitat so that you have a larger and larger area that's not being disturbed by that activity? And that's why I wanted, where are the studies behind how we do, how we think about where you site trails, how often you site trails, what the benefits and the detriments are to wildlife, which is our concern. You know, our concern is not recreation, it is wildlife, as Jane was saying. I think, you know, to make any decisions or recommendations, you have to balance this, and you have to know what the impacts are that you're dealing with. And in our, you know, urban parks, deer do really well because they love the edge and they're no predators, which is different than out in a more rural area where you don't have all of that edge. That's why in the metropolitan area you've seen deer hunting seasons that allow you to take 5 deer, because they do so damn well here versus out in the rural parts of the country where they have more hazards. So it's a very complex issue, and for us to do anything really requires us to look at studies. One of the things that I'd love to know about, and you guys may know or may not know, but one of the real risks of any vehicle, not just ATVs, to habitat is bringing in invasive species. You know, you see it with water, you know, where you're transporting zebra mussels from one body to the next. You don't see it with seeds. And there is no protocol for how you clean vehicles, certainly not our cars that drive off-road, certainly not ATVs. How do you clean them so you're not transporting stuff you don't want to be transporting? You know, I've done some work with folks on islands, and they're so concerned about bringing in invasives to islands that you have to buy brand new clothes and show up in the island with nothing except new shoes and clothes, because your clothes will bring seeds which become invasives on islands. It's clearly an issue for us in Minnesota when it comes to any vehicle that gets off the road, and one that just ought to be part of the how do you manage this situation, which is why I think we need to understand the research before we can make recommendations on what. You have to know, as Ron says, that if you've got a habitat that doesn't have the noise of an ATV going through, it's not really disturbing those that aren't on the ATV. I mean, that's a logical issue. And you know that the animals that are there are going to be less disturbed. I don't know how much less. I mean, I honestly don't know across the spectrum of animals and birds. And I think we just need some more information, which is why I was so insistent that we need a balance. From just hearing from people who love ATVs is not enough. And we need to think about the wildlife impact.
George.
Just as a comment, this is not a motorized issue at this point when it comes to terrestrial invasives. It's a trail issue, because when we're starting to talk about terrestrial invasive species, this is not an issue for just a motorized public as far as that's concerned. This is walkers, bikers, hikers, and dogs, cats. This is an overall issue when you start putting a trail system into an area. It's not something that's going to be limited to motorized. and also under Mr. Shara's comment as well, part of one of the things that we do look at is part of the interoffice interdisciplinaries with the DNR. There's been many, many times that we have not built a trail system based on the concerns because of the silent sports. We do look at that. It is part of the whole process overall, looking at where is this trail system going to go in? Does it fit there? Does it work there? That concern, we make sure of in a couple of different ways, not just their interoffice or their interdepartmental disciplines, but we also open this up for public comment, and we take it extremely seriously from the DNR's perspective, especially because of the fact that if there are concerns from a silent sports perspective, maybe that trail system needs to have a larger buffer. Maybe it needs to move into a different location altogether. Maybe it's not going to go there. So just for that, just to speak of it, we do consider that. It is brought into it. And I do understand the fact that, yeah, we have a much broader footprint when it comes to making noise and being more destructive. And that's part of the reason why we are actually held to a much higher standard in reference to our trails when it comes to before we put them on the ground, well before we ever even say that this is what we're going to put there. It's already being discussed before the trail design even goes, even is even in a concept.
Member Scherer?
Thank you for that. I forgot to mention something, and then Member Hartwell brought up an idea that he thinks we should show up at the trails now nude, I think. Was that what you were saying?
Exactly what I was saying. It would be so much fun to go hiking with you.
That's we'll take
a shower.
We'll take a vote on that. I forgot to ask earlier. You're driving up Highway 169 or whatever, and most of the ATV trails I see are in the road ditches. Mm-hmm. And then I see where they've come down the hill and there's great erosion and there never will be a blade of grass growing there again, et cetera, et cetera. And I ask myself, well, isn't that wonderful? You know, who is anybody come to fix those? Or is that, well, that's none of your members. That's not your trail. I get that. But who fixes up the damage that is done by the free riding ATVers that don't give a damn?
That's a good question. I hate to say that. Huh? Yeah, there is actually available through in our accounts. We do actually have a damage account that monies can be pulled from MnDOT, even, for example, to do repairs on a lot of those things. 9 times out of 10, though, we usually get a local club involved, and they'll come out and they will help. We're using volunteers and volunteer money and actually do that. The other part of the thing is if we have enough use in that road ditch, one of the first things we're going to try to do is encourage them to look at putting that into the Grant and Aid Trail System. Build the trail system into that road ditch where it belongs. So now you've got somebody you've got a steward now. You've got a club that's going to show up. It's going to help maintain that, keep that work done. I do have to agree with you. I don't like seeing that any more than you do, to be honest with you. I truly don't. Because it gives us as ATVers a black eye. It truly does. But yet, on the other hand, it's one of those things with trying to get enough volunteer bodies. Because the fact is MnDOT will tell you flat out, we don't have money to fix that. So their idea would be is just to shut it down. But that's where I've come back to that again. The trail systems, especially Grant and Aid, becomes part of the solution, and it fixes the problem.
Laura, you spoke earlier about WMAs and SNAs being off limits to trails, and I think that maybe gets to the point that Member Hartwell is asking for quiet areas or areas that are not on the edge for species that are not on the edge. And so can you speak to that a little more? Could you give us the fact that those aren't compatible?
Mr. Chair, members, thanks for the opportunity to say a little bit more about that. And I should have clarified that it's not that trails aren't allowed because there are hunter walking trails, but I meant ATV trails typically. So again, if we think of our spectrum of use, you know, our scientific and natural areas very focused on sensitive habitat and the scientific opportunities, you know, that we really have very tight and stringent management and regulations related to that. And so I do think of it as a continuum here. We have aquatic management areas and wildlife management areas that really focus on saying, oh, there's a special aquatic resource here. Let's really ensure that we manage that well. We're limiting the activities that can take place on that land. Similarly with wildlife management areas, allowing some access, hunter walking, being able to get in, but again, different the motorized use not in the same level, with some exceptions. And then as we move along the continuum to state forests, and I think as George mentioned, state forests are a place where we have timber harvest, we have trail opportunities, we have habitat, and they play an important role for so many reasons, our state forests. And so we manage a continuum of state lands with these different levels of regulations and limitations and opportunities, and try to find the right niche for that. And so, you know, with the state forest, this is a place where we do have ATV trails, and we, but it's not that they're just out there anywhere. They're very well managed and designated, and then there's greater limitations on our wildlife management areas and aquatic management areas.
Thank you. Member Blackburn?
You know, I don't know exactly where we plan on going or what we're doing here. I heard somebody say the word recommendation. I didn't think we were doing anything like that. You know, I think in my opinion how this came forward was there's always a lot of questions and maybe not a lot of knowledge on our part, and I'm a person that can say I've been fairly ignorant just because I haven't been exposed to this issue before. So I appreciate any kind of knowledge and, you know, from wherever it comes from, that's going to help me make better decisions or better informed kind of understanding of the projects that we're funding. And so I really appreciate that. I think, you know, when we start talking about invasive species and who brings in what, you know, we just had a presentation on in aquatic invasive species in a project that was funded, even though, you know, there's questions about whether or not it belong to be funded under here. And the thought about, you know, what's bringing it, whether it's motorized or horses or dogs or, you know, humans or whatever, you know, it makes me think about how far do we go with that, right? So in what is within our view, because, you know, for some of these habitat funds that are in the aquatic area, I mean, probably the most damaging thing is people in boats. And do we go that far? Do we say that only thing that we fund on wild rice lakes has to be closed to boats? And a long time ago, when the whole aquatic invasive species thing came up, it was people were saying, well, we should shut down some lakes, these vector lakes. And that's, you know, was not palatable to anybody. There's risks associated with people bringing things in anywhere, as well as animals, you know, whatever it might be. And so I'm not sure where we're going with this. I think to create a better understanding of the projects that come forward and to be thoughtful about, there are ATV trails, there are human trails, there are boats that are out there. These are where human and, you know, habitat worlds coexist. We have to be thoughtful about it, but I'm not sure where we're going right now with this conversation.
I guess my understanding is that we were having presentations for education and information.
So it's not recommendations.
No.
We're not. Okay.
Thank you. Further questions for our panel today on ATV use? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess mine would more be a comment. I hope, Mr. Chair, that you, on behalf of Lessard Sams, will be involved in the negotiations and that we can reach a negotiated settlement on Mississippi Northwoods that realizes all the different interests and things that I think it could serve as a great example of how a land that's got a lot of rolling terrain and a history of being used for multiple purposes and successfully in the past can continue under public ownership to incorporate these different ideas and have a thoughtful process that can actually serve as an example, and we can incorporate. There's going to be some motorized use on that land. There always was, and there'll continue to be. And but maybe we can get some limits on it, realizing there's some really highly erodible lands and stuff involved in there that are really, really cool that we should keep away. And then I'm hopeful that we'll incorporate limited, if any, motorized vehicle during a firearm deer season. You know, maybe we can use some examples of where maybe we allow them to come in after dark to retrieve a downed animal, some things like that that we historically have not done in WMAs, but maybe that can be incorporated here. I certainly hope we use it as an opportunity for some really good examples of youth hunts and capable partner hunts and such. But I understand and realize that when you walk by an area, you actually have more chance to spook a big whitetail than you do driving by in a ATV. But driving by a lot of ATV use does keep animals away from that area, but they become used to cars and vehicles and such that I understand a walker can spook them more, but it's still it's a habitat thing. And Mr. Chair, you're a good, sensible, common sense person. I think that you should be leading the charge to work with the county and the DNR and reach a solution that we can find acceptable. I hope that they're involving you in that process.
Well, thank you for the confidence, and I will certainly make myself available if necessary. Further questions for our panel on ATV? Thank you all for your time. Mr. Bowen, thank you for putting together this group.
And we appreciate the time.
Thank you.
Very good. Thank you.
Just one note. If at any time in the future you are questioning or concerning, please call us. We will be more than willing to come back and talk. Thank you.
Thank you. Good. We'll move to item number 9 on the agenda, and Joe Pavelko will lead us on that one, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Before you have agenda, item number 9, and again, we're talking about revenues. What you have before you on the back of the agenda page here is the draft final language, hopefully, for revenues. Staff has worked with Greg and Janelle and others on this language, and what it's doing is it's if you are going to generate revenue on OHF funded activities, it requires that the recipient of those funds has to disclose it, and that's no later than 60 days after the close of availability. So this is again kind of mirroring what federal funds require. And then if you do generate revenues, it has to be used, again, exactly like what OHF money would be used for, protect, restore, enhance wetlands, prairies, forests, and habitat for fish, game, and wildlife. And it has to be approved in the accomplishment plan. If an applicant a recipient of OHF wants to use funds in any other way, that would have to go back to the council and be approved. I don't see any instance when that would happen, but again, it's in there in case that somebody would want to do that, that there's a provision in there to do that. And then it also directs that if you have revenues at the end of your appropriation period, that it gives direction that it has to go back to the OHF fund after the 60 days. So again, So pretty much what's happening is if you're the recipient of the funds, they have 4 years to get their work done. If they generate revenues, it's being treated just like your OHF revenues, and it's being reported in exactly the same way as your original OHF revenues. So there's no extra reporting except for, you know, just disclosing that you have generated revenue. So it seems to be pretty common sense. You know, we've ran this by a couple of the nonprofits, and they seem fine with it. There is also a subdivision here that, or a number C that talks about that the subdivision does not apply to the state departments and its agencies, and that was in response to the DNR kind of worried about whether or not they'll still qualify for the PR funds. So that kind of takes care of that. So it seems to be a pretty good spot that we're in now, and we've come a long ways to get to this few sentences and paragraphs, and I'm feeling confident that this will take care of the needs of everybody that contacted us.
Thank you. Member Olson, did you want to make a motion?
No, actually, I think you maybe have an error in C. You're putting in an exception for basically the DNR, but what about U.S. Fish and Wildlife?
Yeah, typically the Fish and Wildlife Service doesn't own property, but it really, I don't think it applies here. Pheasants Forever or TNC, they'll acquire property and give it to the Fish and Wildlife Service, but they had no comments and didn't think that this was an issue for them.
Member Kingston.
Right. What about tribes? And in A, why does it say a recipient or grantee? Why do you have to say or grantee? These aren't grants, right?
Mr. Chair and members, this only applies to the recipient. So it would only apply to Pheasants Forever or TNC because they're the recipient of the funds. And the reason that there's a recipient or grantee is that the grantees would be for the CPL program, and they do a lot of the same type of work, and they could actually generate revenue, and that would be what we consider a loophole where, that grantee could keep that revenue and do as they wish, like buying pencils or whatever.
What about sovereign nations?
Same thing. It's grant.
I mean, down in C.
I guess we would have to ask Greg if they're considered a department or an agency, but it applies only to recipients. So if they're not a recipient, then wouldn't apply.
Greg, do you have a comment?
Mr. Chairman and Jane, I think you're right. This subdivision would then apply to sovereign nations or
because
they are a recipient, so it would apply to them. This just waives it for they would not be considered a state, the State Department or agency of the state, and the federal government. They are never a direct recipient, as Joe mentioned. They receive it from an entity that is a direct recipient.
And Mr. Chair and members, I would just add too that there is space in here that if there is something that's not cookie cutter, that's a little bit different, that there is the opportunity for the council to look at it and approve it if there's something different.
Thank you. Let's see. Member Tilley, then Member Blackburn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Joe, you mentioned that we needed C because the DNR didn't want to endanger the Pittman-Robertson funds. How does this provision endanger the Pittman-Robertson funds?
Mr. Chair and members, I think it would be best if we had DNR explain that whole funding mechanism because it's pretty complicated.
And while the representative is coming up, if we're exempting them from the refund stuff, that's one thing. Do we have to exempt them from the disclosure requirements?
Mr. Chair, members, Grant Wilson, Minnesota DNR. Thanks for the question. So the Pittman-Robertson and Dingell-Johnson Acts require that states follow certain requirements in order to be eligible for distribution of those funds. One of the requirements is that revenues off of fish and wildlife lands and resulting from fish and wildlife activities need to come back to the Game and Fish Fund equivalent in the state. And so if that does not happen, the entire amount of money that we're being given based on that allocation is at jeopardy. And so that's a statute, and Mr. Knopf could probably speak more to this, but statute requires that revenues from both WMAs, but anything that's resulting from Game and Fish Fund or that Game and Fish Fund is connected to need to go back to the Game and Fish Fund.
Thank you. That's a good explanation. But I would still like to have the reporting requirements apply to state agencies.
Okay, Member Blackburn. Thank you.
Just a question, and I don't know whether it's connected to what you just answered, but you know, I think about the Forest for the Future revolving account that was approved. You know, that project that's revolving account, and I don't know. It seems like we should maybe know what's happening with that, and does that apply to this, or why wouldn't it apply? Does that get influenced by that act and those requirements? I'm hoping that, that's in order to keep a fund that's going to use it. I have no idea what the results are going to be and if it's going to be applied or if it, goes elsewhere. I don't know what the tails are for any future funding that's returned to that. So I don't know if there's a way that some of these, is that really all exclusive? Should it, or are there things that maybe should come back? When is that revolving fund going to end? So what happens to that?
I'm not sure that. Grant, did you have a
Mr. Chair, members? So I guess I would need to go back and inquire more on the Forest for the Future easements to see what will be required there and how this might play in. I could say generally for state land types, there are requirements for where revenues off of those funds have to return. So, for instance, state forests, I know, go to the Forest Management Investment Account. That's a statutory requirement. For Forest of the Future, I don't know that answer, but I'd be happy to chase it down for you.
I think I would just like some clarification on that revolving fund. What does that mean for this? I've had questions about where that money's going to go forever, and I just don't know.
Okay. Thank you. Further, I guess we don't have a motion yet, please.
I just want to make sure that we're not confusing the revolving account with the forest and for the future.
It's not.
They're two different
things. Are they two different things? Okay, so it's not
things. In fiscal year 17, the forest revolving account, I believe, didn't that get $2 million? I think so. So that's a complete, that was a different format for how it would be spent. It's not part of the forest for the future.
Okay.
Mr. Chair. Members, what I need to do is look into and understand more of the detail of how those easements would be held. So I wasn't referring to the Forest for the Future program or appropriation, but the mechanism of or the kind of easement that those would be held under. But I'm happy to chase down that information and get it back to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair would then accept the motion. With regard to the recommendation, and I know you have a concern, further concern.
I have a suggestion for a cure.
Okay, very good. So,
Mr. Chairman, I would like to move the language, and then I would like to propose an amendment to the language.
Accept your motion.
The amendment I'd like to make is under C, I would like to insert the words, the refund provisions of, in front of the beginning of the C of this. So it would read, the refund provisions of this subdivision do not apply to the state and its departments and agencies.
So they're still required to report?
Correct.
It's not, okay.
And I'm sure the council has ways of making my suggestion work better.
Okay, so we have the motion, and then we have an amendment by Member Tilley that reads that in C, the refund provisions of this subdivision do not apply.
Mr. Chair?
Please.
Could I just offer a suggestion?
Yes.
It's not really a refund. It's really a transfer of the revenue. Because and what I would suggest is, we see that paragraph C, instead of this delete the subdivision and insert paragraph B, clause 3. So the state agencies would be subject to everything else. They would have to spend the money based on the accomplishment plan or what's been approved. They would have to report the money, but they just wouldn't. They wouldn't be subject to the return or the transfer of the money to the Outdoor Heritage Fund.
So, can you suggest that language again? What was your suggestion?
With Mr. Chair, on the document, I would delete this subdivision and insert paragraph B, clause 3.
Okay. Would that be acceptable?
That's
as
very
an amendment?
Acceptable. Thank you.
Okay. And we have discussion on the amendment. Yes, please. Executive Director.
Mr. Chair, members, staff will go ahead. If presuming this passes, staff will go ahead and talk with DNR to see if there's any major obstacles on their side with it or heartburn on it, and then we can come back December.
Further questions or discussions with regard to the amendment? Given that Member Wilkins is on the phone, we have a roll call vote then on the amendment.
Ms. Blackburn?
Yes.
Mr. Hartwell?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Ms. Kingston?
Yes.
Representative Lilly?
Yes.
Representative McNamara?
Yes.
Ms. Olson?
Yes.
Mr. Shara?
Yes.
Mr. Tilley?
Yes.
Ms. Wilkins?
Yes.
And Chair Anderson?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, 10 yes and 0 no.
All right, there being 10 yeses and no noes, we would have approval of the amendment, and then we'll go to the motion to as amended. And we'll have a further discussion with regard to the motion. Hearing none, we'll have a roll call vote on the motion then, as amended.
Ms. Blackburn?
Yes.
Mr. Hartwell?
Yeah.
Ms. Kingston?
Yes.
Representative Lilly?
Yes.
Representative McNamara?
No, I mean yes.
Ms. Olson?
Yes.
Mr. Shara?
Yes.
Mr. Tilley?
Yes.
Ms. Wilkins?
Yes.
And Chair Anderson?
Yes.
Again, 10 yes, 0 no.
There being 10 votes for and none against, the motion is carried and language is approved as amended. Yes, Executive Director Johnson.
Just, Mr. Chair and members, for the record, I'd really like to say thank you to Janelle and Greg for your input and help on this. It's been many, many drafts and different ways of looking at it. And also the Office of OLA and MMB and DNR for their input on it, too. So for the record, thank you.
Very good. Thank you all for your input. Then move to item 10 on the agenda, and that's a review and progress the draft accomplishment plans. And Sandy, are you going to lead us in that one?
Members should have received binders with all the accomplishment plans. In some cases, staff had follow-up questions with managers, and a lot of those questions were answered and amendments were made to accomplishment plans prior to you even receiving them. But this is the opportunity at this point in the agenda to ask any questions of managers that you may have regarding the accomplishment plan. We will be using these plans to write the language and purpose of which they're going to spend the money. So,
Chair would then accept the motion on to progress the plans.
Mr. Chair, I have some questions about that. Before we go further, do you want to do the motion first and then ask questions about all of these, or?
I'd certainly accept the questions on. Yes. Yeah, we can go ahead and have questions on the individual plans.
Yeah.
That's fine. Yes.
So are we going to talk about HRE 04? When do we do that?
DNR, we're going to defer to DNR to discuss the issues regarding HRE 04. They have found a fiscal agent,
okay.
And that accomplishment plan was forwarded to you guys, I can't remember when, days ago, at the last minute. But if you want to ask questions regarding that process and why we came to request a fiscal agent, DNR can explain that for us.
That would be great.
Good morning.
Good morning. Mr. Chair, I'm Catherine Sherman-Hohen. I'm the grants manager for the grants unit at the DNR. And Board Member Blackburn, to your question, and excuse me, I'm still recovering from a cold. I will speak as clearly as I can. With the Knife River Habitat Rehabilitation Recommendation, this is Lake Superior Steelhead Association. They have three phases of the project, and this is their third, as you know. Throughout the first two phases, we have worked with them to mitigate a conflict of interest, which is part of our responsibility by statute and by Office of Grants Management Policy. The conflict is that their major subcontractor, Environmental Troubleshooters, the owner of and president of that company, is also the president of Lake Superior Steelhead Association. And they share other relationships between board members and past contractors. At the time of the original subcontract, we did ask them, and in fact they voluntarily recused themselves, the board members who had the significant conflicts, when Environmental Troubleshooters was chosen. What we have found as we go along is that the management of the grant also creates this conflict of interest between the members' roles on the board and on Environmental Troubleshooters. And I want to be clear that this is not saying that we have found any reason to believe that Lake Superior Steelhead Association has taken any actions that that we would consider fiscally irresponsible in the management of this grant. However, the conflict is so systemic. It's there because of the relationships, who people are, who they've known for 20 years, that for phase three, we asked them to be proactive and to put in place a fiscal agent who will provide the necessary arm's length between the board, Lake Superior Steelhead, and the request for proposal that they put out in which Environmental Troubleshooters will likely be bidding. So we want to start this right and start it now rather than trying to mitigate the conflict of interest down the road. Mm-hmm. I want to stress that Lake Superior Steelhead has been very cooperative. We've had no complaints about how well they understood the issue, how much they've wanted to work with us. I would say they want to put this to bed just as much as we do. We appreciate the thoroughness with which they have found a fiscal agent. And this is something that we asked of them starting in September and October. We started to have these conversations. So it's not something that they could reasonably have come in their initial proposal with.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mr. Please. Chair, in that regard, you know, just to make sure that this doesn't, you know, slip or somehow get, you know, kind of forgotten as a need, I'm just wondering if there's a way that, you know, staff can make sure that they work with the legal counsel to include provisions in the language, in the appropriation language, that clearly states that third party, the requirement of a third party fiscal agent.
Mr. Chair, Member Blackburn, we certainly will do that. We'll work with legal staff to do that. Whether the language will be in the appropriation or be in the accomplishment plan, I think, is yet to be seen.
Okay.
But we'll make sure that there's specific language.
Yeah. And I just appreciate that everybody's been really forward about it, but I know everybody gets kind of caught up in their work, and then, you know, it just needs to, we need to make sure that it's really transparent and done.
Board Member Blackburn, certainly.
Thank you.
Further questions, Member Blackburn?
Well, I do on a different project. I don't know if...
On this same one? Member Hartwell.
I mean, I have a concern that we got a proposal to do a certain amount of work, and now there's a 4.5% service charge for doing that that's not going to the work. I mean, should we find someone to do the work that doesn't require a fiscal agent that isn't going to charge 4.5% for just administering the existing program? That's my big concern with this change.
Thank you. Member Kingston?
I just want to amplify that. We've never done anything like that before. We've never paid somebody to handle the money other than in direct support services. And I see that this line item for professional services on this project went from their original request at $5.2 million, professional services were going to be $9,000, and now with a anticipated amount of 1.758, it jumped to 110.
Yeah.
And professional services are not financial agents, fiduciary agents. It's appraisal, surveys, design, engineering, title insurance, and legal fees, none of which applies to this. So if it goes anywhere, in my opinion, it should be direct support services. But we've never been nicked for a handling fee. And I don't, and I would quash this project entirely if that's the way that we're going to go.
Okay.
Much as it pains me, I'd rather see somebody that is related does something like this kind of work, like Trout Unlimited, or somebody that's a partner. I remember when we first had this project, the first request for fiscal year 13, Heather Koop asked the question. I remember her testifying, and she didn't speak up often, but she did, and she said, "Who's the fiscal agent?" Remember that, you guys? Remember that question from Lake Superior, Steelhead guys? She did ask that question, and that still continues to be a sticking point, so we've got to figure out some better way than this where we're not... I think it's unconstitutional to pay a handling fee. I won't approve it.
Okay.
Member Blackburn?
Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, the administration fund for the Outdoor Heritage Council is 1%, you know, itself. I mean, I think... when you think about administration handling those kinds of things, there has to be a reasonable amount. I don't know that I wouldn't do any, but, you know, we have to live within 1%. I mean, even if it's that, it's a great project. I'd hate for it to not go forward, but 4% is a lot.
4.9. 5%.
So essentially that's it. That's a lot.
Member Hartwell?
We could approve this with the requirement that there be a fiscal agent, but that the organization find money on its own to pay that fiscal agent. And then it's not our problem. They have their own issues. Let them solve their own issues. And I'd be happy to make that motion at the appropriate time.
Further questions with regard to any of the accomplishment plans?
Mr. Chair, in regards to my only other question is on FAO1, the Carnelian Creek project. And looking at, you know, at our last meeting, we talked about, you know, the projects that were out there that weren't having a lot of activity or money spent, including the Metro Big Rivers projects, which Minnesota Land Trust is part of that. And so, you know, those, what I see in here is that we're, and I'm not, I don't know that this is anything that's necessarily wrong or bad. I'm just saying we should really be aware what they're doing with this is taking projects that we had funded through the Metro Big Rivers that they weren't able to spend and taking it and putting it on a different project. And so, and maybe it has that same outcome, but what it sends to me is just a little bit of an alert of, oh, well, you know, we brought people through a vetted process where we reviewed proposals, had presentations, have work plans, and that's what we approved in certain rankings with certain funding. And so I just wonder about how free and easy it is for people to say, oh, well, we weren't doing enough there, so we're going to go with a completely different grant and have outcomes there. And I get it, but it's just one of those things to think about. So I don't know, are we doing changes to the previous accomplishment plans where they have to do updates to those accomplishment plans to take these monies and instead of maybe turning them back in returning those funds, that they're going to be now spending those funds because they didn't get all the funds they wanted here?
Metro Big Rivers would be submitting an accomplishment plan amendment adding parcels.
Okay.
That weren't original to their proposal or to
okay.
their accomplishment plan. And I'm assuming the parcels would be part of the Carnelian Creek area.
Right. Okay. So we're not doing anything as far as this accomplishment plan right now. There's no changes to it. It's just that note that they're going to make changes to their other accomplishment plans where they weren't having those, where they weren't meeting the goals of the previous accomplishment plans and putting them towards this effort.
I can't speak to whether they're meeting their goals or not because
okay.
the project's not finished. They're just looking at using funds from previous appropriations.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair and members, I believe the Carnelian Creek is actually on the approved list. They're just not calling it Carnelian Creek. It's the Terrapin Lakes property.
Okay.
So it's actually there. But the question would be, is once they acquire this, is what are their outcomes and will they have an acreage change?
Right.
Correct. But the project is on their approved list. They're calling it the Terrapin Lakes and not the Carnelian Creek. But the township range and section and all that stuff is that property.
And, Mr. Chair, and so then, and I don't know, maybe it's something for the Minnesota Land Trust to answer. So then what happens with that? Is that part of the overall management the same as the Carnelian Creek Conservation Corridor? Or does the management of that entire area around the Warner Nature Center manage differently because they're different projects? I'm just wondering, is it cohesive? Is it not? Is it actually a project or is it just buying those parcels to protect, but they aren't part of a management agreement for that? It's, I don't know.
Chair Anderson, council members, I'm Wayne Osley, Director of Land Protection with Minnesota Land Trust, and I've heard the conversation, and I can either ask specific questions that you want to state at this point or just respond in general to some of what I heard.
I would say respond in general to what you heard.
Okay. So this project has been part of a parcel list that has been submitted through, I believe, Metro Big Rivers 5, 6, and 7. As you know, it's a large parcel. I think over time, in order to float the project, it needed a number of multiple appropriations tied to it just because of its size. Also, because we've been working through a conversation with the landowners over that time as well. So that's one piece of the equation. We've crunched the numbers looking at the appropriations to Metro Big Rivers and each of those respective grants as well as this potential appropriation through the Carnelian Creek proposal. And we will exceed or be able to exceed the grant deliverables in terms of acres. We also took a look at the leverage piece of it, and we'll exceed on the leverage side of it as well. So from that standpoint, we're comfortable that it will meet the obligations put forth with those respective grants. Refresh for me what other items you would like to have a conversation about?
The management then of this Carnelian Creek. I mean, that was presented to us as a project.
Yeah.
That had, you know, all kinds of, you know, pretty major plans in there as far as, you know, working with Warner Nature Center, having it a cohesive unit. Are those actually going to be then part of this?
Yes, they will. It'll all be essentially one project funded by different appropriations, but the construct holds together.
Okay.
So we need a new draft appropriation plan, right? That shows that in there? I don't have it with me. I'd want to be looking at the Carnelian Creek draft appropriation plan to see where those, where the portion that's broken out for MLT is in there. Is that in there? I don't know.
I'm not.
See that the. In the original request, the various partners are broken out.
Right.
Should be.
Right. And that's the piece I'm talking to, even though it's the Metro Big Rivers partnership. Each of the members get a specific appropriation to...
We don't have a Metro Big Rivers draft appropriation plan now, right? So it should be in this Carnelian Creek project, right? What we're talking about?
Well, and that's why I don't know.
It was from previous rounds.
Previous rounds.
Yeah, it's from previous rounds.
How do we dovetail the all the land management requirements and so forth?
So, Mr. Chair and members, so I would assume, and Wayne will have to talk to this, but you will acquire the property as one property,
right?
And you'll have multiple funding sources, and all of the funding sources will, the 4 years that you're using OHF will have four funding restrictions recorded on for the entire property because you're using all of those. So you won't actually be buying four separate chunks of the property. It'll be one transaction with four funding restrictions recorded on the entire property.
That is correct.
Could I ask one more question? So I'm just curious as to, you know, the progress of this project, and it's possible this isn't a fair question. So was the reason why there wasn't any activity on those previous appropriations was because you were waiting for the full thing to come together? I mean, I feel like there's been so many things we haven't had transparency on about this project that I just have a lot of, I guess maybe, you know, I'm a skeptic. So I don't understand how there's been no activity, but, you know, suddenly the thing that you were trying for, at least in the your proposal even here under FA1, it kind of comes together, taking money from all those other projects, even though they may have been listed. It just feels maybe not really authentic to me. So, and maybe there wasn't a question, except for that, did you know about this, and was that part of the plan? And I like I said, it's probably not a fair question. It's just things I'm thinking.
Yeah, Julie, as we, I think, discussed that at the last meeting, you know, we have been working through a list of projects. Our Metro Big Rivers 4-1, we're on the verge of closing out our obligations there. So one project completed, another one about to close on that project. For 5 and 6, we had put out a request for proposals and had gotten a number of significant projects put before our eyes, which we are about to entertain. Clearly, when we're looking across the metro as a whole, this project, the Carnelian Creek project, is our number one priority. And so when the appropriation numbers got finalized, then we needed to take a step back and look at how we might be able to fund that and make that project viable. So we looked at that and were able to, by looking at each of the various appropriations available to us and the remaining funds in those appropriations, account to about $4 million that we could put towards the project. And the remaining gap, which is about another $1.5 million, to get to that level we thought we would have a viable project around, We had the conversation then with Washington County as well as the landowners to see if we felt confident enough that this project was viable at the scale that we proposed it, and got the confirmation that we should proceed forward. So that's where we're at. I understand where you're coming from, but part of this is also looking at the playing field and what the opportunities are before us. We have, you know, with that, we'll have about $300,000, $300,000 to $400,000 available in Metro Big River 7 to pursue those other priorities that will be coming through our, that came through our RFP process. And if we're working with some of that can be acquisition, but hopefully we'll get some donation through that as well.
I just think about the, for instance, the Conservation Fund didn't get fully funded for Bushman Lake, but had it been on their parcel list before, could they be able to take just that and put it forever? And maybe that's fine. Maybe that's fine. I don't know. I'm just thinking about what is it we review and what is it we expect, and are they the same? I don't know.
We're on FAO1. Representative Lilly, did you want to speak to that one? Okay. Member Hartwell, on that issue?
You know, we've had a lot of projects before that have used multiple appropriations to fill them out, who have planned on doing it in the first phase and not gotten the project to actually work until the third phase. And projects flow in and out of these parcel lists and get combined. This is not that unusual. If we don't like the fact that they're using multiple year allocations, we need to stop that everywhere, not just pick on one project, because this is not unusual. But it's not, protecting the land is not different than what the Nature Conservancy has done and used multiple year appropriations to get projects done, or government agencies. This is not any different than that. They're just putting together the various resources they have to do these kinds of projects. It's
you
been,
might be right.
You know, tell me that I'm wrong.
This happens quite often, and personally, I appreciated the fact that they had transparency in telling us how they were going to get the funds, because they were not fully funded. That would have been a question we had, and they answered it right away off the top by putting it in their accomplishment plan.
Yeah, it's probably just me being a skeptic. I'm serious. I don't think it has been transparent, so I appreciate that you are now. Of course, I just have more questions. So,
Mr. Osley?
I do want to also make the statement that initially we did propose this to run through the Metro Big Rivers proposal. I think due to its size, it would be a substantial request. We heard from the partners that were part of the partnership that it might make sense, better, more sense standing on its own as opposed to being couched within, you know, the full partnership proposal. And that was a decision that we made, and that's why it's showing up as a separate proposal, just in large part because of its size.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
Representative Lilly, did you have a separate item you wanted to challenge?
I did not.
Okay.
Thank you, though.
Thank you. Member Tilley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I just have a couple comments. I don't know who to direct them to, but on HA04 and HRE07, in both of those proposals, the fee title acquisition of parcels is being dropped. To me, when you do fee title, that gives public access. When you do easements, you don't have public access, and I just dismayed that we're losing some fee title acquisition in these two projects, and that's about all I wanted to say. But thank you.
Thank you. Representative McNamara.
Well, I guess I would like a follow-up to Member Tilley, and wondering if is the Leech Lake Area Watershed Foundation here? I'm curious what they're going to do with this money, and now that fee title's not happening, I guess I'd like to hear about those easements. And I think we're talking in our paperwork, there's $112,600 here, and then there was talk about donated easements. How do they fit? And I'm just curious on some of that, if they could answer some of those questions, get some of that on the record.
Hi, Lindsay Ketchell, Executive Director of the Leech Lake Area Watershed Foundation. We had a very difficult decision to try to make the project budget. The budget recommendation required us to make some significant difficult decisions, and one was to drop the fee title acquisition. We also recognized, though politically, it was a controversial fee title acquisition additionally, but we wanted to focus on the conservation easement program. And currently, right now, we have a wait list on our Clean Water Critical Habitat campaign. And again, these are 38 Tulabee Cisco lakes that we are targeting to protect. So we currently have a wait list of about 25 landowners, and those properties have all been graded. And if we are allocated the funds, we will continue to do what we do, which is do outreach to landowners who are in those watersheds and collect those applications, and then we grade those based on both their ecological function and also their cost. The other thing we want to try to do a little bit differently than we've done, and we've noticed that there are probably on each lake 3 to 5 what we would call tier one, the best parcels to protect. And instead of doing more of a generalized outreach, we'd like to actually become a little bit more surgical and put a little bit more sweat equity into the developing those relationships with those landowners and spending that quality time. And so there's a little bit additional staff hours that we're going to be seeking, but we think in the long run, getting the best parcels available will end up with the best results. And we currently have about 3 or 4 donated projects in the queue. So these aren't just individuals who are seeking out funds and compensation. They're actually landowners who are very deeply concerned about their lake ecology and understanding they have a stronger or bigger purpose in life. So that's the positive that we are experiencing, that there is a number of very thoughtful landowners who are very interested in being part of the solution.
And then just to get on the record, yeah. You take into account if people are willing to donate back part of the,
it's
in your formula and how you're judging these,
yes,
ranking them, I should say.
Yeah, and so absolutely. We look at rate of return on investment, we look at ecological scoring, and then we have a technical team who also reviews each one of these applications.
Representative McNamara?
And tell us what the deliverables will be in the end. What will you deliver with these? How will it be any different than what's currently happening? What's going to happen on the landscape and on those easements that you secure? How are they going to be any different? Are the people really, what's different going to happen to the lake and to the Ciscos because you're giving these people this money?
Well, our premise of thought has been all along that if you reduce the amount of development around a lake and in its watershed, you can sustain or its water quality. And that's really what we're working for. And the understanding is that if you can protect about 75% of that watershed, a lot of this is forested, so you're still having sustainable forestry going on. But if we minimize that high development risk, especially around the riparian zones, we have a very good chance of creating what we would describe as a protected class of lakes. And that's really our deliverable in this next phase three is 3 to 5 what we are going to be describing as protected lakes within that watershed, and that's our long-term vision, is to create those protected classes. So it's an understanding development pressures onto water quality.
Okay, and thank you, Mr. Chair, and can you tell us a little bit about, so you rank them somehow, like they're zoned for residential development and they've got them plotted out and you're going to, now that's not going to happen, or is it somebody has their McMansion and their 20 acres and they just want to get a little money because they're not going to let anybody else build around them anyway. How do you incorporate that?
I would say, well, we try to keep it to science as best we can and use science to grade if it's sensitive shoreland. We look at wetland types that are on the property. We look at the pressures of development. And absolutely, we are interested in identifying and working with, and we currently have, very large landowners for the most part who could potentially do a significant amount of subdivision. So the development threshold is a huge grade. And so each then category gets its score. So we look at the numerical value. But then we also bring in a technical team that then reviews each one of these applications. And those are folks from DNR, soil and water districts, to really also give that local perspective in addition to the numerical value in that process.
Member Kingston.
Just a real quickie, please.
Yes.
John Sumption?
Yes.
He's under contract?
Yes.
Okay. Not under
personnel?
No, no. He's retired, and so he works as a private contractor. But he really does serve as like an employee, but so he's under contract. Go ahead.
What kind of qualifications does he have?
What qualifications does he have? He used to run the Cass County Soil and Water District for 20-plus years.
He's zoning.
Yeah, he's... I actually feel like he's been a champion of conservation easements and the use of easements for water protection probably his entire career. And we're very grateful, actually. That's one of the benefits of working in a retired community. You actually get to pick up some amazingly skilled individuals to work with a little nonprofit.
Okay. Staff member Pavelko.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members. So one question I have is, you know, as we're thinking about the accomplishment plans here, you know, usually there's some sort of hard number deliverable tied to receiving the funding. And this, with the Leech Lake, we're going to have an accomplishment plan with the Leech Lake Area Watershed Foundation and an accomplishment plan with Minnesota Land Trust on this. And there won't be, just so we're clear, there won't be a acre deliverable associated with the Leech Lake Area Watershed Foundation. So I just want to make sure that we're all aware that you know, Leech Lake Area Watershed Foundation is going to receive funding, and there's not going to be a hard deliverable that we can gauge success or failure onto, except for the program as a whole. So I guess this is not common, I would say.
Yeah, and just so there's clarity, our partnership with MLT, we actually go out and do all the landowner recruitment. We do all the promotion. We actually do all the fundraising and wrote the grant that you reviewed. MLT is a great partner of ours, but and we are in the community. So we're the ones who have the long-term relationships with these lake associations over the last 20 years. We are in their communities. We do all the lake association presentations. Their staffs are in the city and in Duluth. And so I think that, honestly, they wouldn't be able to make some of these accomplishments without our participation, I would think, Wayne. I think we play a little role in helping out there. I guess the tractability that we're going to be looking for is, again, creating these protected class of lakes that we are going to try to deliver. The other option is that we could just have one accomplishment plan for both of our organizations, and they aren't separated out. I had seen us as being the lead as the lead applicant, so that could be another possibility. But we work very well together, so
I just need a little
Member Blackburn, yes.
Clarity. So, Joe, can you help me understand what you're trying to say? So, in this accomplishment plan for this project, there's an abstract that has numbers. There's numbers in the back as far as the outputs. I'm confused.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members, so there'll be two contracts. There'll be money will go specifically in the appropriation language. It'll specifically say 100 and however much Leech Lake gets. It'll say that specific amount of money to Leech Lake Area Watershed
right.
Foundation and a specific amount to MLT. MLT is the only one that has the money for the actual easements.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay, so. The easement acres will be tied directly to those funds when they're reporting it.
Okay.
So we'll be able to look at it and go, you know, $500,000 bought us X amount of acres. With Leech Lake, when we look at it, it's going to be, you know, they spent $112,000, and it's not going to be directly tied to an acre
right.
or that deliverable. And so is it what – should we have some other deliverable, or is it acceptable – to just lump them all together and say that these two work together to do it. And I just want to make sure that we're all aware
okay.
that that's how that's working. And that will be the same thing for deer hunters and conservation
okay.
funds as well.
But
so I just wanted to make sure that everybody's aware that's
yeah.
how it's
yeah.
going to work.
Yeah.
It's kind of a thing of splitting and lumping. Is that what you're saying? You know, if we consider the whole thing as one entity, everybody that's associated with that one entity can... has part of those accomplishments.
Right. Yeah.
But since it's a separate contracting, even though they're doing all the landowner contact and
right.
kind of teeing up those things, they won't actually get counted
or credit
accomplishing
right.
that.
Right.
So
And I just want to point out in Phase 1 and Phase 2, we are doing a fee title, so Joe is correct. In those two contracts, I have a strong deliverable that is a number that can be counted because I am closing actually on the Woods Bay project on Thursday and Friday.
Please.
But we just closed on an easement project with MLT associated with Phase 1. While I wasn't physically there and or not involved in that contract, we still feel like we play a role in that process.
Member Hartwell.
So, you know, if this were a concern with deer hunters and this proposal, you could structure it so that the contract is with MLT and MLT contracts with Leech Lake. Mm-hmm. And it would get us the same result, correct?
Mr. Chair and members, technically you could do that, but if you do that, then, you know, you have to follow the RFP process to contract. I don't think it's allowed that you could specifically, you know, call out your contractor in the accomplishment.
So the Nature Conservancy has to put out requests for bids. They can't just, as part of this process?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
If they get a grant to do prairie restoration, they can't go to their the folks that they're most comfortable using for their restoration and give them the contract? It has to go through a state contracting process?
It has to go through a competitive bid process. Right, unless, like Greg said, unless it's specified in law that it's specific to whoever.
But in this case, you know, MLT putting a contract out to do the work that only Leech Lake is qualified to do, it would be kind of a silly thing and end up in exactly the same place.
Yeah, you'd have to justify it through the sole source requirements. But, again, it's just I wanted to make sure that we all understood that that's how this was working and it's not.
Right.
So at the end, we're not.
And we have this and the Deer Hunters and Conservation Fund that are both doing it exactly the same way.
Correct.
Okay, other questions?
And please. I just would like to share, you know, we feel an enormous amount of ownership for this program as a small little conservation organization. We partner with MLT, but we actually feel like we're somewhat leading this effort in a thoughtful way. And while clerically, whatever you guys decide to do, just know that we are working collaboratively together, and when they put an acre on their result sheet, I feel very responsible and have helped make that happen, I guess is all I'd like to conclude. Thank you.
Thank you.
You know, I wish that we could find a way to resolve this, because what I don't like is how that reporting does happen, and it looks like we're, you know, paying for a sales force that has nothing to do with an accomplishment, and that just feels a little uncomfortable. Like, I feel like it should be neater than that. I mean, they're packaged in the same, it's the same project, so I don't know what else can happen, but I don't know why we'd want them reported separately. We have lots of other projects that there's lots of different partners working on things together. I clearly don't understand why this is not together.
It would seem to be cleaner.
Just one more comment, maybe, if I will. Part of another consideration in separating these things in the past has always been transparency. From an accounting standpoint, DNR Grants and Management then has the opportunity to look at each, you know, very much in a deeper way into the accounting. And so that's been one of the reasons for keeping things separate, too. And in the grants, of course, or in the language of the bill, when there are more than one partner, those partners each receiving individual appropriations, those have been separated in the bills.
All right. Further questions with regard to any of the accomplishment plans? Chair would then accept a motion to progress the plans.
I would be happy to move the plans progress with the modification that the FAO, what is it, 04, HRE 04?
Yep.
Exclude the 4.9 or whatever percent it is of fiscal agent fee from that, and that that be the responsibility of the Knife Lake. Lake Superior Steelhead Association.
Here.
That's my motion.
Okay. Accept your motion.
What?
Discussion. Member Kingston.
I'd like to hear from Lake Superior Steelhead as to, you know, alternative fiscal agent plans.
Possibilities.
Possibilities.
Good afternoon. Introduce yourself to the record, please.
Craig Wilson, President of Lake Superior Steel Association.
Kevin Bovig, LSOC Grant Manager.
So the question is the possibilities of a different fiscal agent or not having the 4.9% funds?
Yeah, I guess I would say originally we were told to do this. We weren't really, we did not volunteer to do this. I will say we have had a litany of DNR people and other entities reviewing our plans, our permits, our projects, our invoices, and there's not been any issue with any of that. So we are certainly under a great deal of scrutiny. As a matter of fact, on the way down, I counted up. There are 18 governmental agency people and governmental agencies that are reviewing every project we do. We only have six people working on this through four different companies, so it's not just all environmental troubleshooters who's doing the work. That should be clarified. There are several other people doing the work. Now, we have six people essentially doing the project, and we have 18 different people in government that are reviewing our work. That's three government entities reviewing per person who's actually physically doing work on the project. That would seem to be a lot of scrutiny in my case. And in every case, there's never been a single problem brought to our attention. So I don't want people to think we're just running out pretending we know what we're doing. We have a pretty experienced staff and pretty experienced people, and we've done exceptional work, quite honestly. We have been trying to work with the people when it was brought to our attention, again, that there was an appearance that there could be a potential conflict of interest. Now, when we originally had our first grant, we went through this with Patrick Donnelly, I believe was the person at the time. We submitted a conflict of interest policy. He signed off on it through the DNR, who was in the process of overseeing all this Lessard stuff, and we believed at the time in 2012 this was resolved. That's how we went forward. This was just brought to our attention here, I don't know, roughly a month and a half, 2 months ago. And we've been trying to work with the council to alleviate any concerns they have, and they actually recommended the fiscal agent, and we thought that's what the council wanted, so we went along with it. It would not be our preferred pathway, I guess I would say.
Member Kingston.
Isn't it fun to be regulated?
Oh, I just love it. I can't tell you.
Well, you know, I'm sure that you'd rather just do volunteer work with your volunteers and be happy about all the good work you do, and I don't want to squelch the project, but I don't want to pay 4.5 handling fee, and I won't approve it. So we've got to try to figure out some other way to do it. It shouldn't be in professional services, certainly. I mean, that's a line item change that should be changed.
It's fine.
It's really a direct support services appropriate charge, and then it's too much. And then it's like, isn't there some solution to this?
You know, my motion is to give them the responsibility to find the solution, whether it's with the DNR or some other way, and it just shouldn't come out of these funds.
And we'd be happy to do that. We don't really want to come out of the funds either. That's what I'm trying to say. We did not say, yeah, let's lose a bunch of our money to go to something that's already being done successfully.
And
so
it's your responsibility to put the whole package together.
Correct.
Right.
Yeah, and if that's what the council is telling us, let's go back to the drawing board and come up with a better solution, we're happy to do that because we're not real thrilled about the solution we're involved with.
I mean, they don't have anything to do with this work.
Correct.
But I would say that they have to conform with the DNR's
right.
grant process,
of course,
and it's up to you to figure it out with the DNR, and we're just going to approve the money for the project.
Yeah, and that's fine. And we currently have a conflict of interest policy that had been approved by multiple people in the DNR, and Lessard people signed off on it.
Can you find someone?
Let them.
Yeah, I think we can, yes.
Good.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Any more questions?
Your questions?
I just a comment that I know, I mean, everybody kind of has to go by the same thing, and there was, you know, there's a huge list of all of the requirements everybody receiving a grant has to make, and the DNR doesn't make that up. That comes from statute in the Office of Grants Management. I completely get that. I understand your frustration, certainly, because I've been in your shoes before. I think trying to figure out a way that it's a third party that is credible. I mean, that's why I think it still has to be, there has to be some review of that and guidance of that, because the fiscal agent is a pretty high standard that has to be met as far as the audit standards, the requirements for reporting. And so it's a stringent thing, and it's got to be taken really seriously. And so they can find their own, but for goodness sakes, you know, there's got to be some guidance there, because the Office of Grants Management policies are extraneous. And so I don't want them to go through this again and come back. There should be some help somewhere in trying to figure out what is the kind of criteria that they're looking for in order to do that.
Executive Director Johnson?
A little more information on that and question. The grants management has, as you heard Catherine testify before, they've been working well with LSSA to figure this out, and they also have been working with us, with staff. It's been a round-robin type thing. And those were all in preparation for today, which I hope you all understand that it's all about whether the council approves this or not. Staff just tries to help people prepare for council presentation and bring the information here, and then the council makes the decisions. Any fiscal agent change would, in my opinion, definitely have to be approved by DNR Grants Management. And staff would like to be in on that as well in reviewing that. The amendment as it is, or the modification to the motion which David had made, was that the fiscal agent fee, whatever that is, would be the responsibility of LSSA and would not come out of the grant, out of the OHF funds. It would be match or leverage that you all would apply if this motion were to pass. And at that rate, the fiscal agent would still have to be approved through grants management, whoever that fiscal agent is. But that comes down to my question, which is that a fee which you feel you can find leverage for or match for?
Well, I guess there's several things. I mean, part of this, we're putting the cart before the horse. Yes, we have a club in place that has a pull tab account that could pay for somebody to provide a third-party oversight. So to answer your question simply, yes. We're making a lot of assumptions. First of all, we're assuming that I'm going to bid. I have not formally made that decision yet. Two, we're assuming I'm going to get the bid. That certainly is a step that is bypassing the entire RFP process. I'm sure there's a lot of people who step up here and think they're going to get work with the RFP, as was just mentioned, that with the Leech Lake people, don't you have somebody in mind? I have no doubt they're going to go through an RFP process, and there's certain people that are better suited for the project than others. But there's no guarantee I'm going to get any work. That's certainly never been promised, never been mentioned to any extent. There could be somebody out there who is better and more qualified, and they would certainly get the work. We're a pretty qualified company, have done pretty good work. Would I think we would at least be shortlisted? Yeah, I would be pretty disappointed if we weren't shortlisted at least for an interview, but certainly there's no guarantees that have ever been given us. We have to go through a rigorous RFP process. We have invited, from my understanding, the DNR can sit in that process and review the proposals, and they can also comment on that. We've asked Catherine if she wanted to be involved in that, to sit on the review process, and she could then also make her determination who is the most successful successful people. The end result is the club wants to hire the most successful people. If that's environmental troubleshooters, so be it. If it isn't, so be it. We should have a chance to go through the RFP process like every other firm gets a chance to. And the best firm should be selected for the project, whether it's somebody who's worked with the LSSA before or somebody who hasn't. And that's certainly no guarantee I've been given. So I don't really see the value, quite honestly, of a fiscal agent. I see the value of having some other additional people in on the committee to select the firm, and then that discussion could be had in the open, and then that findings could be saying, well, maybe there appeared to be a conflict of interest, but here's the review of the RFPs, and here's the findings, and that eliminates that appearance.
Thank you. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I'd ask us to take a deep breath on this entire project, and don't want to judge you, your firm, or the fact that you're here on behalf of advocating for funding for a project that then you may financially benefit on. As somebody who's dealt with those challenges in the past, I think it would be best for us to take a deep breath at this point on this project and ask that Mr. Chair, that you and staff and involve the DNR in this project, and we not take any action in regard to this project until we have a better understanding of what's going on here. I don't want to dive into the fact that you're here raising two hats, but you clearly are here raising two hats, and that's troubling for me, and I would rather have the DNR and Lessard Sams dive into this and see what we should be doing here. You may be the best person in the world, and I'm assuming you are, but it's a real challenge when you work in the public sector and having spent 30 years in that sector. I certainly know, but I got to be honest, I never came here and testified on behalf of getting funding for a project that I potentially could be involved in. I'm very troubled by that action, and I would ask us to not deal with this project at this time. We're going to be back here in December, and I would ask you, Mr. Chair, to work solicit help in what's going on. I don't want to prejudge what's going on, but just based on what you just said, we should take a deep breath on this project.
Member Hartwell.
I'm not going to disagree with you at all. I think the reason the DNR has asked for a fiscal agent is clear. You know, there are so many potential conflicts or perceived conflicts of interest. You cannot have the organization that you're affiliated with potentially contracting with you, because if something goes wrong, who's going to enforce? And a fiscal agent will do that in a way that the organization that you're on both sides of can't. So I get the fiscal agent. I just don't think it's our financial responsibility to do that. I think the cleanest way, frankly, to do the project is for your firm to have nothing to do with contracting for this because of your involvement, and that would be the cleanest. But if that's not what your organization wants to do, then I think a fiscal agent is incredibly appropriate, but we should not pay for it.
Further, Representative McNamara, are you looking to table this one for the time being?
Well, I guess I would just ask, we all need more information on this project, and I want to give you a chance and your group a chance and to work with the chair and staff on what's going on here. I didn't anticipate the testifier saying what he said, and I think it has serious implications. And I'm a short timer here. I'm gone, but I think I've already said enough. I don't want to cloud up the waters and what's going on. I don't want to prejudge. But this can look really shaky. This is $3.392 million of public funds that I think we should all take a deep breath. And if Member Hartwell is willing, I don't know what action we need to take today. I know we're back here in December, but specifically in regards to this project, in this part as far as continuing the process on, I certainly think we have a great bill, but I think we need clarification on this one, not only the fiscal agent, but what is in the intent of this group, and who we need a fiscal agent here, absolutely. I don't know who it's going to be, and I don't expect anybody to ever work for free, but this one here needs more clarification for somebody to dive into, Mr. Chair.
So are you suggesting that we approve the accomplishment plans holding this one out for more clarification and information. I think it's clear. You know, they need a fiscal agent. My motion, and I'm happy to amend it, but my motion is go ahead and do the project, but you have to have a fiscal agent, and we aren't going to pay for it.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and Member Hartwell. I was all fine with all that and understanding all that, but now the revelation about some things that are above and beyond that in regard to this contract, I would like the St. Louis River Restoration Initiative project and for the folks involved to evaluate what they've got going on. You made the mention that maybe there's somebody that shouldn't be part of the bidding of this process or the doing the actual work because of other involvement, and I don't know what it all is. I just think it would be best to take a deep breath. I would not want this project to be recommended to the legislature just as it is right now based on what we've heard. I think I would like you to understand what the laws are in regard to what's happened, and I don't really know it all, but you've been here and testified on behalf of a project, and never once did I know that you were also potentially a contractor for that. And as I said, I spent 30 years contracting in the public sector. Believe you me, I never testified on a project that I was going to bid on. And I'm not judging what you have done. I'm just telling you, okay. This is coming from somebody that spent a lifetime.
Well, we can certainly meet with the council if that would be what you'd prefer. Yeah.
I think, Mr. Chair, I think the final say on HRE 3 and what their proposal is to us would be best to be evaluated in December. So, however... I don't want to pay $153,000 for nothing HRE either. HRE 4, okay. It says HRE 3 here. Oh, I might be
the that's second page. Next page.
Am I on the wrong project?
Yeah, Knife River.
Oh, it's not $4 million?
No, yeah.
$4 million?
Yeah.
Well, you're making me feel, what? Oh, 1.7. Oh, yeah. Chicken change. Yeah.
It doesn't change.
Right, sorry, I was on the wrong amount, but the right project.
Yes.
So whatever Member Hartwell would like, I've voiced my concerns.
Executive Director Johnson.
Sure. And just to let you know, staff will move forward with whatever is decided by the council. But just to reiterate, there have been, actually, I think it was mentioned by Catherine in her testimony before, there have been some other prerequisites necessary that have been put forward by with consultation with DNR and also with staff. And one of those is that if environmental troubleshooters is going to be involved in putting in for the RFP or applying for bidding, that's what I'm trying to say, Craig would have to be, before that happens, he would have to step down as president from LSSA because there's an obvious conflict if he's both. And he would also have to be not just recusing himself, he'd have to step down as president from the board. And there were other factors of that nature, too. Anybody else who was connected with it would have to, at minimum, be recused and so on. If this is held out for review in December, we can make sure that all of that is bulleted for the council and that it's gone over again with LSSA. But whatever the council decides, staff and DNR will work together to make that.
And Mr. Chair, I don't want to preclude you from whatever. It's not me to judge the situation. I just think a little more transparency between now and December will help you, your organization, both of the different organizations potentially involved.
And I'm fine with that. I'm not disagreeing with you.
Cool.
Okay, Member King.
I'm sorry, I just have a point for staff. The bundle that came with this AP approval has HRE 3, page 1, then it has the whole accomplishment plan for HRE 04, which we didn't have before, and then there's this other page, 3 of 18 from 02. What's this one?
Mr. Chair, members, that one refers to the, has a correction on the, is it the FTE? There was a typo.
Oh, yeah. What's the project number on that one? I remember asking that question.
02?
No, it was, restoration
right.
Evaluation?
Yeah.
Yeah. 02, not 02.
Correct, yeah.
So okay. I have a proposal to see if it would meet your approval. I would suggest that we move this forward, not paying the fiscal agent fee and having the DNR report on what the final negotiation is on how they want to handle it with a fiscal agent before the council would approve the project, which would happen next spring after the allocations made by the legislature anyhow. Does that feel better to you?
I would
Well, your
restate my amendment slightly.
Okay.
Or restate my motion with the
provision
for this project.
And so if I understand the provision, it's to exclude the paying the 4.9 for a fiscal agent and asking the DNR to come back.
Fully report and get our acceptance of whatever the plan is.
Everyone understand that to be the motion and progressing the accomplishment plans? Further, and I don't believe Member Wilkins is on. Betty, are you on? I believe she's departed. Further discussion with regard then to the motion? Hearing none, then the chair would place the question. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
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 Oh, member Greg, we still need to do a
yes.
roll call?
Yep.
Mr. Chair, since you announced beforehand that there's going to be a member calling in, I think you need to follow the law on a member calling in throughout
right.
the meeting.
So we will have a roll call vote then. Thank you, gentlemen. Amanda, if you would do a roll call vote on the question of the progressing the accomplishment plans.
Ms. Blackburn.
Yes.
Mr. Hartwell.
Yes.
Ms. Kingston.
Yes.
Representative Lilly.
Yes.
Representative McNamara.
Yes.
Ms. Olson.
Yep.
Mr. Shara.
Yes.
Mr. Tilley.
Yes.
And Ms. Wilkins. Mr. Chair, 9 yes, 0 no.
Thank you. Motion has 9-4 and none against. The motion with the provision is approved. Thank you. Anything else under the agenda? I don't have anything here. Anyone in the audience that wishes to address the council at this time? Seeing none, would remind you that we have a meeting on December the 14th at 8 a.m. And I wish you all a happy Thanksgiving, and we'll stand adjourned.